speaker.
Please submit speaker card.
Roll call.
If you can go to the chair right
there. Go to the boss there.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Steve Mission, Steve Ramon, Bob Shell. Okay, I guess we're trying to get ready. So every time I think I run out of stories, Mother Nature helps us out. So we haven't had moisture on the coast in months, and we're trying to plant pumpkins in this wind and dry and sunny and hot and just not fun. I started pulling my garlic yesterday, and we got the heaviest drizzle since February rains tonight. So I guess the only way I could look at it is driving over. I'm not running the U.S. Open today. So those boys from the hot country better bring a sweater. The coast is cold today. So at this time, we'll have a roll call, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliade.
Here.
Mr. McGrath.
Here.
Hi, here. 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 This is our fabulous five, I guess, at the moment.
Fabulous five.
Don't take our restroom break or we'll be in trouble here.
Or a timeout if you don't have any left.
That's right. So I guess at this time maybe we should just jump over and get some of the important information out of the way. As you remember, in our last meeting, I said the hardest part about serving in government that day was what I could not say. And naturally, the next day, the governor announced that made a new appointment to the regional board with our board member, and he's our second. A state board, yes. Our second state board member to come off of this regional board, and Steve Moore. So we got him back this month, so we're very, very excited and thrilled to death that he's had this wonderful opportunity to step forward and well-deserved opportunity. And after I read in the paper this morning about the governor raising heck on the iPads with the insurance industry and everything, about the only thing we could give you was your nameplate here, but there is more, so come forward. We actually do have a real little certificate for you.
Are we going to charge him for that? Is that the new requirement?
No, but we're going to take a collection.
I don't think there's any reason we can't give him this, and he can kind of put it on a windshield.
I'm sure the state board can
put it on the windshield of his car when he goes into his fancy parking spot there. But, this is a brief presentation for you, Steve, and all of us can't thank you enough, and the most well-deserved appointment this governor's made recently, in my opinion. And you truly are not only a great board member for us in the state, but a friend also. And I'll let all the board members make a comment as they will.
Steve, we are so thrilled and proud to be sending you to Sacramento. You're going to be a great state board member. You have great people to serve with, and I just am looking forward to watching what you folks do in the next few years. I think it's going to be a wonderful time. It's going to be a roller coaster for you, I'm sure. You're going to be doing all the hard work. We would like to moan and groan a little bit because we miss you very much here. You've been a really a stalwart board member for us, partly because of just who you are, but partly because of your experience coming up through the regional board. You had a background knowledge of issues that none of us could match, and we always really appreciated your insight. So we wish you the best. We hope to see you often, and congratulations.
I will add a few words of mine, Steve. I've seen you. First of all, I congratulate. I call it a promotion or whatever. Secondly, I have seen your passion for the environmental quality in you. When you really come out from your heart every time you spoke. You really meant it from very bottom of your heart and very dedicated to environmental quality. That's what I've seen you. I'm very sure you'll carry that passion with you at the state level and do your best. And I think I wish you the best in your life and best for the quality of environment in California. Thank you.
Steve, we're really going to miss you.
Your mention here, we miss your insight, but I think you're going to be a very good addition to the state board. They need you there. And good luck.
Thank you.
I first met Steve when we both had more hair. And he won the race. But I can't remember the exact time. I remember working for the Port of Oakland, and there was this staff guy over at the regional board that really knew wetlands. And I had spent many years working on wetlands, and it was really nice to have somebody that really knew wetlands. And then he worked on the airport runway. And I got to know him in some clandestine meetings in that effort, and where San Francisco Airport thought that I had been sent by Oakland Airport as a shill or as a ringer to derail their plans, and then I got to know him as a state board member. You've made things happen. I think we look at trash, which I didn't recognize as the issue, and you look at who made it happen, and it was really you and David Lewis. And that's not the only thing, but while you've made things happen, you've also kept a sense of balance and a really strong technical perspective. And so it has been an immense pleasure to serve with you and to be regulated by you. Immense. It was reasonable. And I'm glad you're where you are. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to wrap it up from the board's perspective here, Steve. They called me a number of times during this lengthy process for you, and I said, what are you guys waiting for, really and truly? You have someone that's knowledgeable, someone that understands regional work, understands statewide work. I would have appointed him 3 weeks ago, but anyway, that's how much power I had. But I told them that you're a great appointee because you're balanced, and I think that's the key to good political appointees is how do we be balanced in government now to kind of work with all groups and all parties involved to do the right thing for not only the environment, for business and the public interest. So I think that's a wonderful opportunity for you. And my final comment is that good leaders have to make tough decisions, and it's always easier not to make a tough decision, but I know you can do that. And today we're giving you compliments and accolades and everything, but let me tell you, there's going to be a lot of people out there giving you hell, too. So just be prepared for it. So God bless you, and thank you for teaching us, all of us up here, how to be better board members. So appreciate that very much. So. Staff.
Well, I think your comment about balance is appropriate because we definitely want to make sure we have more Stanford representation at the state board since there's already too much Berkeley representation there. So we'll get that balance. But while we'll definitely miss having him as part of our own board, obviously we recognize the benefits both statewide and specific to a lot of the issues that we're very very close to. We're not letting him totally go because we're allowing him desk space for when he's not wanting to make that long jaunt to Sacramento. He's keeping his key card, so we have to be careful about being able to get into the building and that sort. So we hope to build on the opportunity of the fact that he's really moved up the chain from all levels of being on staff to regional board and now to the state board of being able to plug in with him. But we know from his experience on this board that he's going to be able to apply everything, you know, he's learned or taught us over the last 25 years, and so I think it's going to be great. And so we're definitely going to miss him here. We're going to miss having him join you on the board, but in the grand scheme of things, this is a big deal, and we're very pleased.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
All yours.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm floored, obviously, and humbled. I'm very excited to serve in the new position on the state board. And I'd say, you know, coming into this, I recognize that in California, water resources touch every individual in numerous ways. You know, whether it's passion for the environment, or just, you know, day-to-day needs, or economy, you know, you name it. Recreation, the whole nine yards. And it's interesting, in state government, you don't necessarily see the water issues rise to the top, you know, of the priority sheet. And yet we know here in our experience how it really does touch everyone and how important it is. I'd say, you know, I really appreciate the kind words. Serving on the regional board was a learning experience every month. I learned a lot from my fellow board members, and I just really want to thank you for your kind words, because I feel the same about each of you in terms of the wisdom and knowledge that you bring. So this regional board is going to be just fine because of the excellent personnel that serve. And I just say I'm really grateful to the governor for, you know, trusting my type of background to be able to serve in this position. So I hope to live up to a fraction of what the expectations seem to be. I appreciate it very much. So today I'm serving as a liaison from the State Water Board to the Regional Board, but I'm not going to be your permanent liaison. You've seen enough of me around here. But actually, another great person in the system, a great appointee, Felicia Marcus, who lives nearby, will be the liaison from the State Board to the Regional Board. She's taking the oath on June 25th, and so you'll see her the next time you meet. So, and, you know, I'm not far away, so if she's giving you any trouble, you know, I'm right around the corner. We could let her know how we do things in Region 2, right? Anyway, we'll move on. So, in my capacity as liaison, I have a few little things that are happening in Sacramento. I've been fully immersed and still taking in the fire hose of information going on up there. I'll start off maybe on more of a down note to talk about the budget. You know, the Department of Finance considers the state to be in a continuing fiscal crisis, so additional positions are going to continue to be limited, and we're going to be generally constrained to redirecting existing positions, and any expansion of existing programs is going to be heavily scrutinized. That should come as no surprise. Unfortunately, it looks pretty probable that we're going to have to all take a 5% pay reduction, and the unions are negotiating how that will happen. The likely alternatives include one furlough day a month or a 4-day work week of 9.5 hours per day. And so that's the latest I have. Now I'll talk about issues and legislation. This month, I thought I'd maybe just share a little bit of, you know, my experience as a state board member with you. The first meeting was a quiet meeting. The board members and staff were very kind to me. There was really not much controversy. To give you an example, we adopted a resolution that was consistent with a Senate bill recently, SB 482, which moves the administration of the beach safety program that the counties implement from Department of Public Health to the water boards. We were funding it anyway out of the Waste Discharge Permit Fund, so there was a kind of a bureaucratic slowdown in that system anyway. Department of Public Health was happy to let it come straight to us. So, and then, you know, we use that data more than Department of Public Health anyway, as far as assessment and that sort of thing. But it was one of our routine things we looked at. Also, we authorized Prop 50 coastal non-point funds for monitoring. That's like a swamp, you know, the surface water ambient monitoring program. Well, there's these along the whole coast in the ocean plan. We have areas of special biological significance known as ASBS, and we have several in our region, or your region, sorry. The region I live in, yes. For instance, James V. Fitzgerald Marine Reserve, which is in San Mateo County. And so now there's a discharge prohibition in the ocean plan for pollutants into ASBS. So recently in March, a resolution was passed granting conditional exception to the discharge prohibition to ASBS because many of these ASBS are near cities like Pacific Grove, Carmel, Moss Beach in San Mateo County. So a total of 27 entities have applied statewide for this exception to the discharge prohibition in the ocean plan. It's a lot like what we have here in the basin plan, where we prohibit discharges that receive less than 10-to-1 dilution. We grant exceptions and conditions in this region for those discharges. So there's monitoring required as part of this exception program, and so these Prop 50 coastal non-point funds are meant to provide funding to those entities that discharge to these ASBS areas. So give you a little flavor of kind of a day-to-day issue that wasn't that controversial. Now, moving into controversy, there are three statewide general stormwater permits that are either out for comment or will be released this month. The Caltrans and the small MS4 permits are out for comment now, and I encourage your input. There's workshops being held in various locations in the state, and the industrial general permit will be released later this month. Now, as far as the items on our agenda next week that I can't answer any questions about because they're pending, there's the on-site waste treatment systems, or the septic systems policy, which I've learned has been a long and winding road, but over a decade, and it's on the verge of being adopted. Also, there's this little issue of flow objectives with the Bay Delta. We're going to have an info item on the workshop structure that's being proposed, and we're looking at late August, early September, and then early October to have workshops on the Bay Delta plan update, and that focuses from the state board standpoint on flow objectives, water quantity objectives to the Bay Delta system. There's a table 3 in the existing Bay Delta plan that has existing flow objectives. And so the regulatory exercise is to look at that table and make modifications based on technical information. So we're going to have a series of workshops. Coming up in July, the construction general permit is going to be amended to comply with a court order to remove numeric limits for site runoff. But in this construction general permit, the numeric effluent limits will be retained for advanced treatment systems that remove sediment. We're also having in July a workshop on the petitions that have been brought on the Sacramento Regional Wastewater Treatment Plant MPDES permit. These petitions were brought by both the discharger and environmental interests. Now, moving on to some interesting regional board news. In legislation, the budget trailer bill includes a provision for reducing regional board members from 9 to 7 and removing the specific designations for the positions, such as, you know, industrial water use where I served, or water quality, you know, irrigated agriculture, et cetera. So that's on the table. What's not on the table is this idea of combining Region 7 with Region 9 and reducing the regional board numbers. Also, the idea of the governor appointing chairs or having the chairs serve full-time, that's not on the table. So, but the reduction of regional board members is in this budget trailer bill. And actually, what might be of interest to you is the idea of raising the per diem amount from $100 to $500 per meeting passed the Senate, but it didn't pass the Assembly. So that's still under negotiation and subject to political pressures, I'm sure. Also, there's another item that's still on the table, which is to have the State Water Board prepare a report to the legislature by January how to reduce the number of regional boards. Have the State Board prepare a report.
And that's great, because you're going to do all of that with a 5% reduction in pay and a day off during the week. So, good.
Anyway, I'll just let you, I'll let everyone think.
California, you're on a hell of a track, buddy.
Think about it. Everyone can think about that. Okay. There was a water recycling bill that Tam Dodek reported on last month that Water Reuse was sponsoring. They're likely to pull it because there were some issues that came up in the weeds about the details of moving from the water code into public health code. So word in Sacramento is that'll be brought up again in the fall and continue to be worked on, but it's been tabled for now. So as I mentioned, Felicia Marcus will be your liaison, starting, I guess, probably in the August or September meeting, and I'm going to be the liaison to Central Coast and North Coast. So I'm excited to learn about all those the issues there and the things we have in common, what we've learned here. And I guess I would leave, in response to all this, these wonderful things you've said, and I'm really humbled by. Along the way, in becoming appointed to the State Water Board, I repeatedly gave examples of processes and products and efforts and positive outcomes that have been achieved by this regional board and its staff, focusing on collaboration and taking that little extra time to work directly with people and gain trust. And the remarkable record of our uncontested calendar in the 4 years that I had the honor and pleasure to serve here. I hope to have some semblance of remote, similar experience at the State Board moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Bruce.
Just to follow up a couple things on what Steve said, he noted the budget trailer bill that would reduce membership on regional boards from 9 to 7. When we say budget trailer bill, what this means is that this is a bill that would be traveling with the budget. Essentially, once the budget is signed, the bills that enact the budget would be signed at the same time. So if that is included, and as Steve says, it looks like it is, we anticipate that being included, along with the provision that my understanding is that six of the board members would be essentially no category, that they would be appointed based on knowledge and understanding of water quality issues, and one would be quote-unquote public. We've heard on the side that they expect to say that basically anybody who's currently on a board is considered knowledgeable in water quality issues, so falling into that category. But essentially, what this means is that once the budget is signed, and if that's in the trailer bill, then that wouldn't necessarily affect our membership because we're less than seven already, but it would mean that the quorum would drop from 5 to 4, 4 being the quorum for 7. And so that moving forward hopefully will allow us a little more leeway in being able to preserve a quorum for this board. There, to my understanding, there's only one board at this point that has more than 7 appointees right now, and they would be expected to have some attrition before they got new appointments. I know some of you are up for that your terms expire this year and would be up for reappointment, and there hasn't really been very many specifics on if there's going to be anything new and different in terms of the appointment process moving forward. We also understand that Governor's office is vetting some potential appointments for this board, but as Steve experienced in his appointment process, that's sort of a black box as to how and when appointments come. So at any rate, we do expect, it appears at this point, to see this change in board composition. And it gets back to a concern from a number of people in the legislature saying that when you have 9 boards and 9 members plus 5 more at the state board, that's 86 appointees and 86 appointment processes and confirmations. And they're essentially saying, you know, we love you, water quality boards, but you're not worth it for 86 appointees. And so this is part of the effort to streamline a little bit the board process. But I think in many respects it will help us moving forward. As Steve also noted, the potential provisions of consolidating the Colorado River Board into the San Diego Board and the governor's appointment of chair, that has been tabled at this point. So we don't expect to see that.
It's my understanding, too, we had the recent chair's call, that the way they were going to do this elimination would be that the upcoming board members that are up for appointment would be the first 2 to go off. Is that the way you understand it in Sacramento?
Well, this demonstrates sometimes the theory versus practice differential, because I think that many in the legislature don't recognize the fact that at this point there's only one board with more than 7, mm-hmm. and so there's really not a lot of action that needs to be taken. And so that's why I say some of the specifics still need to be worked out, because to just say that anybody up for reappointment at this point would be the first to go, in our case, that would drop us down to 3. So I'm sure that there is some time to work this out during the fall season, but that would be after the budget put into place. We do understand that there's a strong push to get the budget approved and signed before the end of the fiscal year, but I think we've all worked enough in this environment to know that may not happen. So we have I've talked with the chair about recognizing that we will only have 4 members at most available for our currently scheduled July meeting. And if we don't have any either new appointments or this quorum reduction, we'll not be able to hold a July meeting. But I think we'll wait another week or so to see if there is anything that's really moving fast enough to allow us to hold the July meeting before we say that we'll cancel that for lack of quorum. So I'll keep in touch with the chair on that, and we recognize that both parties might be coming before the board in July, and the staff work that needs to be done for July, we can't necessarily hold that out until a week or two before the meeting. We need to have some advance time on that, so we'll get that resolved in the next week.
Great. So there's been a lot going on. The only thing I would push for is with retroactive $500 a day for the last 16 years. That would help the garlic dry.
We'll see what we can do.
Got a dream.
Cover 1 year's loss in the pumpkin business.
Yeah. So, anyway, there's been a lot to report on, and during the chair's report, I just have a very quick report. So I have no card on item 2 for public forum at this time. Anyone like to speak? Otherwise, we'll move on to the minutes of the June 8th, 2011 board meeting.
I'll move approval.
Second.
Moved in second. Roll call vote, Mary, please.
Aye.
Okay, maybe it'll make it easier.
Mr.
Yeah.
Aye.
Mr. McGrath.
Aye.
Dr. Singh.
I was not there, so I absent.
Dr. Young.
Abstain.
So there were 3 of us. I don't know what that means. We're pretty close to approving the minutes.
It passes.
Approved. Thank you.
We didn't vote against it.
That's right. You didn't vote against it. We're going to challenge our legal team to continue to stay with us on this form world. So at this time, and I know it's been difficult for our helper Ray, but nobody's fault but my own. It's just too much paperwork here.
We may want to do the board member reports before we do the swearing.
You're right. So we did the minutes. All right, this is not my first meeting. So the only good news, quickly here for personally for us here, City of Half Moon Bay, Steve, take note. First time in their history, we built a new addition to our police station, and we built a beautiful bioswale. Can you imagine that? And so we're diverting water back into the ground where all you guys have been pushing for all these years, so we're really proud of that. Also building a new beautiful large school district is building a new artificial turf track, also with wonderful drainage and bioswales in there and setbacks. And now the only issue is there's some individuals that think artificial turfs are going to poison our little soccer players, so we have to work through that right now. But I think that's great news. Bad news for the Gophers, because the Gophers really have a tough time getting through that. And Dr. Young well knows how the Gopher world works. So, but we're really excited about doing a good thing, so they can come over to our bioswales and work in there, right? And that's all I have, board members. So I'm going to start down here. We'll get the board member graph, and then I'll let you wrap it all up.
I'm going to be pretty quick. It's interesting. I'll just report on real quickly on four things. A group of us did tour the Valero refinery. It's interesting to look at how the conventional treatment technology gets modified to remove the oily loads and the selenium. It was quite interesting. Then I also had the good fortune to attend a lunch given by the EPA Alumni Association. I'm going to have to get Terry into that group. It was a chance to say hi to Jake McKenzie, who's on MTC and mayor of Petaluma, and congratulate...
Roner Park.
Roner Park? Okay. And congratulate Felicia Marcus on her appointment. I think I got that one right.
Yeah.
And I continue to poke around and listen to different people for their perspective on what the most important things. So I did meet during the week with the BACWA board, and I have breakfast with Reiner on Monday to get the SFAI's perspective. And when I've got enough there, I'll probably ask for 10 or 15 minutes and kind of try to sketch out some common themes and ideas and where we might go with them. So that's all.
Very good.
Yeah. We did visit the Valero refinery, and I really was very impressed with the treatment plant, storm water and industrial water. Very well done.
And Dr. Singh?
Well, I have so many news in my head that I don't know where to start from. But first of all, I start some personal notes. Three happenings has happened in my family as yet, which I'll call happy news. First thing happened, on February 27, I had a great grandson. So I believe it's fourth generation. So my daughter's, eldest daughter's daughter, had a son at a Stanford hospital. Secondly happened that my daughter-in-law, my son, the youngest issue I have, got married, and she had joined the family on March 14th. So that's the second news happened. But third news I'm going to give to you, a very brilliant young man, my grandson, in Fairmont Hotel, got married on June 19th with a physician's lady, both of them from University of California. And he has his own company in Palo Alto. And the lady is a physician. So there are 4 days of celebration, 400 people. So I just came out from the nightmare I had for 4 days. And all the performance and... So that's my news. I'm really saddened to see that our state employees don't get salary increases for years and years. On the top of that, they have to take a 5% pay cut. And also governor and also Democrats of his party are disagreeing. He wants to make severe cuts in child support, health, home care for disabled, and many other programs which benefits people who are really in need, and aid to some seniors. The richest country in the world, we don't have a universal health insurance. I've been to only three countries where I lived. I lived in Canada, I lived in India, I lived over here. And the only country in the world which I don't have a health care coverage for many, and some people. So, but another thing, my experience over the years has been, when I came in 1960 in this country, I spent a lot of my time in this country. I was a young man, and I grew old over here. At that time, I didn't see any homeless people. I didn't see any beggars on the roadside, and I stop whenever I can without having a traffic accident. I give a dollar whenever I see somebody, whatever reason could be. Some people say, but there's so many people going in the garbage bins and picking up cans and bottles. But there is, I don't know, maybe... I don't want to make any more comment, but that's a saddening thing. So anyway, I can make some other comment about environment, but I let it go. One good news I was reading 2 days ago, that last year, over the our last 12 months, the solar power activities in this country has increased tremendously. Although the wind power activities have gone down, but wind power was only an insignificant amount. It does impact environment. The solar power, many people, due to the government incentive, have increased the activities. But right now, I was reading in news that most of the solar panels comes from China. I don't know why this country can't produce it. But U.S. government has imposed 31% duty now on Chinese solar panels, so now it will become kind of inaccessible to many people, and many people are discouraged that they can't have a solar panels on their roof because the cost has gone up tremendously, something like 50%. So this is something to consider. I'll thank you very much.
You keep giving parties, you'll be collecting bottles and cans too pretty soon, buddy. Dr. Young, and I know you have a lengthy one, so feel free. You well deserve it with all the work you do here, so go for it.
Appreciate your perseverance. I have five things. The first is an item that I want to call to the attention of the board. It is a resolution that was passed by the ABAG Executive Board on May 17th of this year, and I, thanks to Bruce and Tom, have copies for you. It was put together by our great friend, the San Francisco Estuary Project, and our partnership. I'm sorry, I keep going back in time. And Judy Kelly is here, and I hope everyone takes the opportunity to thank her for all of her good work now that she's in the audience. But this particular resolution has to do with asking the requesting that the health of the San Francisco Bay Delta system be adequately considered in the discussions that are going on about what to do about Bay Delta flows. Basically, it's very timely because of the report that we heard today from Steve, and actually we know that the debate has been going long on, you know, for my lifetime at least. The resolution refers very specifically to the 2011 State of the Bay report with which you're all familiar, in which diminished freshwater inflows to the Bay Delta system are noted to coincide with declines in the resources that depend on those flows. And specifically, in the resolution states that we have been in a state of chronic drought for some time. And I'll just go, I think this is important enough that I'd like to just go quickly through some of the items that are in the resolution. ABAG makes the point that a healthy and sustainable Bay Delta ecosystem includes adequate not only water quality, but water outflows and water supply. I mentioned earlier that we have been in a state of chronic drought. They make the point that regional self-sufficiency is linked specifically to reducing reliance on exports from the Delta, and requests that be taken into account by the State Water Board, Delta Stewardship Council, and BDCP. The resolution makes the point that protecting the economic viability along the shoreline of the Greater San Francisco Bay Delta depends on freshwater inflows. Requests that full financial disclosure be available, that is, the that realistic cost estimates would be calculated and made clear to everyone before final decisions are made. That there is proper representation of local governments in, that is, local governments around the Delta and Bay, in any new proposed governance structures around the Delta, and that flood protection be accomplished wherever feasible through the rehabilitation and restoration of wetlands, as well as in the more with the more traditional methods of flood control levees and structures. So that's a sort of a summary of what's in the resolution. On June 8th, the chair of the Association of Bay Governments sent a letter to Mr. Hoppen at the State Water Resources Control Board requesting that representatives of ABAG could come and talk with the State Board about this. And I have a copy of the letter. Steve, I'm sure you'll be seeing one soon, too, if you haven't already. I think this is an extremely important watershed moment, let's call it, that ABAG has been given such careful consideration to this issue and has produced the resolution and is following up on it and going to make the voices of our cities and counties and our jurisdictions in the area be part of this very important conversation that's going on statewide. If there are follow-up questions about this later on, we all know who to talk to. Everyone's in the audience. Okay, number two, I wanted to bring another subject to the board's attention, and that is that we are, per the terms of the regional stormwater permit, going through the process that we had outlined for developing the methodology for calculating the trash baseline and also the methodology for the compliance monitoring for our requirements to do percentage reductions over the next 11-year period or the 11-year period from the time we adopted the permit. We have had several submissions from the permittees that have been a matter of public record. They're available on our website. More recently, our staff has written a response letter, I understand, which is also now public, to these submissions that talk about the methodology that's going to be used for this compliance. I think this is an important enough issue for all of us. And as Jim mentioned earlier, we really took a hard look at the trash issue when we were adopting this permit. That I would like to request that the staff create whatever opportunity you feel is appropriate for the board to be able to discuss the issue at some future board meeting. So I just lay that out there as a request.
Are we looking at that a little more policy on that trash issue, that bring it back to us then? Is that kind of the direction you're thinking also?
I don't want to voice an opinion in an appropriate manner here. I guess I think that there are that this is a matter of policy and not just a matter of numbers and calculations. So
that's good.
If I can put it that way. I don't know. Bruce, you may want to say things that
we recognize this is a very significant portion of the municipal regional permit, and at that time the provision with the goal of by 2014 reducing trash by 40%, 70% by 2017, and essentially zero by 2022 was very a significant component of that permit. That permit dates to 2009. It said that the methodology for determining the baseline and for moving forward would be submitted by February 1, and the short-term plans, in other words, how to get to the 40% by February 1. And the letter we just finalized last week, a review of those submittals and spelling out our concerns over our sense that based on what's been submitted, that it does not appear that we're going to get to the 40% by 2014 based on what's submitted. This is a significant area and significant enough component of the permit that I think it appropriate that we have a workshop or information item in the coming months to review this, because recognize that the permit that we all worked so hard on was 2009, and we're coming up to the 2014 consideration of reissuance, and so we do want to make sure that the board has an opportunity to weigh in with some direction to us, but also that the community is aware of what's going on with the whole long list of activities and actions that the permit called for, especially on trash, since it's so significant. So we will try to queue up in coming months how we can do an information item workshop on that, not necessarily to have it be a decision making, but more so an information and time for the board to provide any input or guidance that they want to.
Thank you very much. Okay, three other quick items, which are just reports on meetings. I did meet with Dr. Reiner Honecke of SFEI to do two things, actually. We discussed how one monitors stormwater and non-point source discharges from a technical perspective. I was given some valuable education, which is what I went in for with this conversation, and I appreciated it very much, because SFEI, of course, has a great deal of experience in monitoring these types of discharges, even in our area that has quite variable weather patterns. We also discussed the one of the guiding parts of SFEI's mission, which is to connect science to policy and decision making, and try to shorten the distance and the time that it takes to get from science to policy making, partly by creating the science that's necessary for good decision making. It's a very, very interesting discussion, and I'm hoping that SFEI will, in the coming couple of years, perhaps do some more additional informational items in front of this board, just to keep us abreast of the advances they're making in that regard. I met with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission with Steve Ritchie and Paula Key, along with some colleagues and of mine at the Stephen J. Bechtel Jr. Foundation. I found the presentation that the PUC that Steve gave to us a few months ago was very interesting on the in-building recycling. I knew that the foundation had some considerable interest in this arena, so I just put them together and sat there like a fly on the wall. You won't believe that, but I did. Sat there like a fly on the wall. Didn't say a thing. Lastly, I just wanted to report a more lighthearted effort that arose from a meeting that I had with Dr. Mike Connor, during which we both drank too much coffee and kind of got excited about various ideas. And so we thought, wouldn't it be fun if we could get the San Francisco Estuary Project to do a YouTube contest to illustrate the unintended effects of consumer contaminants, getting at the issue of emerging contaminants. So I was able to stop by and at the implementation committee's meeting of the SFEP recently and proposed this idea to them. They agreed to look at it. We had a fun time discussing it, and perhaps you'll even see in the future some funny videos that are memorable enough to get people to look at what's in their shampoo bottles. Anyway, that's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Two PhDs in coffee. That's scary. Yeah. Really. Whoa. Just quickly on the trash, you know, we've all really worked hard on this plastic bag and polystyrenes and all that, and you know, we're trying to reduce it, and it looks like we are making some headway, but yesterday at the edge of the field, somebody dumped a load of carpet. So, you know, you got to kind of look at who's putting trash and where, and those same people are still going to be dumping trash in the future, and I know it's off the agenda item, but it's something we got to consider when we're looking at trash reduction, that we got to get these people that are dumping trash to stop dumping trash, not just plastic bags and polystyrene.
There's no one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, thank you for that. So we got that out of the way there, and I think we can go ahead and go on to...
I'll make a couple of comments.
Oh, that's right.
Thank you, Terry, for bringing up the letter we put out to the municipalities on the trash letter. As I say, we'll follow up on that and bring that back to the board. I do want to call the board's attention to the item in the executive officer's report on dry cleaners. This has been an issue in front of the board for some time. We expect to have more site cleanup requirements, other items before you in coming months. It's definitely not something that's going away, and that the item pointed out how the press is starting to recognize this, which in some respects is a good thing to raise the profile. We know very much that it's going to be a long effort to both identify who are the responsible parties, but in many cases we're finding that those responsible parties don't have the wherewithal to address the pollution and contamination they've caused. And so that's going to be the ongoing challenge to try to both make sure we're identifying the parties, identifying what needs to be done, but then trying to see how we can help facilitate the funding to get the work done in a timely fashion, because we have been finding that the pollutants not only are affecting groundwater, but the fact that they then can vaporize up into homes and buildings is a public health concern. So this is a significant issue that's going to be regularly in front of you. Buried in the enforcement summary was the fact that I signed a action that assesses a $10,000 penalty on the Lehigh Quarry down in Cupertino area. This quarry has been historically the Permanente Quarry. Kaiser owned it, and it's moved through a number of ownerships, and is very convoluted in terms of its operation, and the community is concerned over a number of aspects of it. Recently, there was news that the U.S. EPA did an evaluation as to whether it should become a Superfund site and determined that it didn't rank high enough on their evaluation to become a Superfund site, but that they also recognize there are significant concerns there, both from water quality, air quality, hazardous material handling. And we fully recognize that and are working to, with multi-divisional approach of how do we adequately regulate this site. The penalty assessment was for a one-day discharge, but in our mind, that's a minor aspect of this site, and so we're going to be doing a full evaluation, and this will be something that will be coming back to you over the coming year as we're looking at how do we appropriately permit and control their actions moving forward, but how do we appropriately recognize the quarry operation where there's been a number of a large quantity of spent material that's been placed on site. How do we appropriately handle that and make sure moving forward that if there is cleanup that needs to be done, it's done, and that the past practices are protective moving forward. So that's something you'll be seen, and potentially, since it is a hot button in the South Bay, you'll be seeing mention of this in the press. I do want to sort of wrap up saying that we recognize that the train seems to be leaving the station on a likely 5% reduction of some shape for staff. The board's asked earlier in the spring that we report on the budget for the coming year, and once the dust settles on that, I will come back and provide an in-depth discussion of what the budget means. Obviously, a 5% reduction, as Dr. Singh brings up, is a challenge when essentially we haven't had raises, and if anything, we're being cut back. The bottom line is that it does limit our availability and our ability to respond to all things that are coming in front of us, and so I'll use that budget discussion as an opportunity to point out what it is that we are essentially funded and must do, and how this limits some of our nimbleness to respond to situations. But we still recognize that is a balancing act, that there are situations that come up over the course of the year that we need to put resources in along with sort of our expected efforts of permit reissuance and addressing other components of our program that we plan out ahead of time. And so it's this balancing act where we have a 5% reduction placed upon us that continues to be the challenge. Good note is that we do have two offer letters out. When we've had opportunities to hire, we're overwhelmed with applications, so that we've gotten very good applications, and we feel we've made two good offers. So hopefully the next meeting we'll be able to do introductions. The downside is that it's quite likely those are going to be the last hires we're going to be able to make for some time, given the way the funding is moving forward. But I'll report further on that in the future.
Very good. Thank you. And
I will mention one last item that I think came up at your chair's meeting is that it has been essentially cast in stone that this fall's Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting for all the board members will be November 1st and 2nd. That's a Thursday, Friday. And that there still is an effort being put together to have an optional Delta tour on October 31st, Halloween. So it could be quite scary. But certainly there'll be more specifics on that coming out, but just to get that on your calendar.
Thank you. And thank all of you for your patience. This has been kind of an unusual morning with our lengthy reports, but it just goes to show you the hard work that board members put in pro bono, really and truly, to try to make everything better in this Bay Area for all of us in the water quality thing. So I thank you for your patience, and we'll try to move on here as quickly as possible. So at this time, we'll do the swearing in. All relevant evidence that any person's desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of witnesses at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed
following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand, please. You promise to tell the truth.
So do.
Thank you. We're completed there. So we will move on to item 5 on the uncontested, and we could make some comments if there's comments that need to be made on uncontested. We'll take a motion, and then we could have a discussion. Is that correct?
Right. There's only one item on the uncontested calendar, general permit for discharges from dry dock operations. I'm not aware that you have any cards. And we
no, but that, maybe Jim, and yeah. I want to make a very brief comment about it, too, and anyone else. So
I would also make a comment that I think reflects the history. When I was a young pup at EPA, I remember Lois Green going down to Upper Newport Bay to look at all the boat operations and what a mess it was and what was to be done about it. And now, being involved in maritime activities and watching these things, to look at the degree of control of not merely runoff but aerial emissions and dust and the degree of use of Tyvek and things like that, and for it to have it to be routine. The one thing that I did talk with Bruce yesterday, and I think it's important to point out to achieve both a recognition of the efforts of the staff and the balance, you're not going to have the reflooding of a dry dock with no residue. The question is, will that residue lead to either water quality exceedances or the accumulation of material? And the process here, I think, requires best management practices and a wipe standard, and doesn't automatically require power washing. But if the exceedances end up piling up, then it does. So I think there's an effort to make sure that we recognize the system and we hold the more perhaps expensive treatment methods in abeyance to make sure that they're necessary.
Let me clarify, because it's a terminology. As part of this, the facilities would be required to implement best management practices in including power washing, but power washing is, yes, it's a strong flow, but it's different from pressure washing, which is very high PSI flows. And so the pressure washing would not be required unless, after the wipe samples, that triggered further action. And so this is sort of an incremental approach, and it's actually consistent with what was adopted in the permit for the bay, ship, and yacht that you adopted last year.
For this to become standard practice and not contested in terms of the progress we've made is rather remarkable, and I appreciate both the effort of the industry and the staff in getting us to this point.
Okay. Just the screen.
Yeah, and I kind of just take it to a little bit further. I think, you know, we got to be careful. We look at the lesser of the two evils, you know what I mean? If we put the pressure on the applicant or the permittee, then, you know, we're doing the right things, but I'd rather try to keep it under control there than to have it coming out of Suisun Bay, too, you know.
Well,
I think that's what we've all worked towards, and so I actually,
right,
follow along Board Member McGrath. I'd like to give him a compliment that they're trying to really get this thing to work up there, hopefully not only for betterment of the water quality, but also for the business community, and hopefully getting some employees going up in that area there and things like
well,
that.
Well,
so that's part of my thought there.
Yeah, and the driver for this general permit is twofold. One, over the past few years, starting in 2008 when you adopted a permit for applied defense recycling at Mare Island to reopen the dry docks there, then followed by permit for the BAE Systems large dry dock in San Francisco, and then last year Bay Ship and Yacht in Alameda. Essentially, we felt we achieved something with the Bay Ship and Yacht that we wanted to make consistent throughout. So this is an opportunity to sort of have a attempt at a one-size-fits-all. However, we're also recognizing that there's talk of a new dry dock going in Benicia in response to potential mothball fleet work, possible expansion at Mare Island because there's additional dry docks there that weren't part of the original permit, and even talk of reuse of the dry docks in Richmond. And so this provides a more streamlined approach that rather than have to come back to you with a new permit, which essentially would look like what you're seeing today, this sets up a system where by having the general permit, then new and current permittees can just apply to be covered under this, but it's consistent with essentially what we've been adopting to date. And so this sort of makes it an even playing field for all parties, but hopefully streamlines the process moving forward.
That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you. A motion to accept...
Move that we adopted.
Yeah, contestant.
Second.
Moved and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So ordered. Okay. Moving on to item six.
Item six is consideration of reissuance of the NPDES permit for the Central Marin Sanitation Agency. And I'd like Vince Christian to give the staff presentation on this.
I just want to clarify that I looked at the secondary treatment plants, all their TSS.
Yeah, I saw your... Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Board. My name is Vince Christian, and I work in the Wastewater Permitting Division. I will briefly describe the Central Marin Treatment Plant and then cover the issue of blending, which was the main focus of the comments we received. The plant is located on the west side of the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, just north of San Quentin Prison. It serves about 130,000 people from San Rafael and the surrounding area. The community has very little industry, so most of the influent is from residences. This diagram shows the flow under normal conditions. Incoming wastewater goes through screening and grit removal, primary clarification, secondary treatment using trickling filters and aeration tanks, and finally disinfection using chlorine. The plant capacity, which is limited by its secondary treatment capacity, is 30 million gallons per day. Dry weather flows are about 6 million gallons per day, and under normal conditions, the plant works very well. There have been no permit violations over the last 7 years. However, in wet weather, rainwater leaks into the collection system through inflow and infiltration, and this dramatically increases flow to the treatment plant. Inflow and infiltration is a problem in the collection systems owned by wastewater agencies and also in the lateral lines owned by individual property owners. Here's a specific example. The lateral line connecting this home to the collection system has collapsed, causing this sinkhole next to the curb. Here's a close-up of the sinkhole. During large storms, rainwater flowing down the street flows directly into the sewer system. Inflow and infiltration can result in flows larger than the treatment plant can process. When this happens, the treatment plant must modify its operations to handle the increased flow. At Central Marin, when the flows exceed the 30 million gallon per day secondary treatment capacity, excess flows are diverted around secondary treatment units and then blended with the flows from secondary treatment prior to disinfection. This is known as blending, and it happens at Central Marin about 24 times each year and typically lasts about 10 hours each time. In the example scenario shown here, the influent is 31 million gallons per day, so 1 million gallon per day bypasses secondary treatment. While the concentrations of pollutants during blending conditions are typically lower than during dry weather flows because of dilution, the mass of pollutants being discharged in the long term is slightly higher because the wastewater receives less treatment. US EPA strongly discourages blending as a long-term management strategy, and it developed a draft policy in 2005 outlining the steps that a discharger should do to show that there are no other feasible alternatives to blending before the regional board should approve blending. While the EPA has not adopted the 2005 policy, we use it as guidance, and we require all dischargers that blend to perform an analysis during each permit cycle. Central Marin performed an analysis during the previous permit cycle, and it identified treatment plant upgrades to reduce blending. These photos show the recent construction of Central Marin's $20 million wet weather improvement project to reduce blending, which was completed in 2008. Central Marin thinks these improvements will significantly reduce the number of blending events per year and the blending volume during each event. Central Marin has not proposed any further improvements to the treatment plant to reduce blending, nor have they proposed specific improvements to the collection system, which, as I previously mentioned, is the cause of blending. This is because Central Marin owns and operates very little of its collection system, and therefore has no authority over the satellite collection system agencies that do. This map shows the service areas of each satellite agency. Central Marin controls less than a mile of sewer line immediately adjacent to the plant. Sanitary District No. 1 of Marin County, also known as Ross Valley Sanitary District, owns about 200 miles of sewer lines serving Larkspur, Kentfield, Green Bay, Fairfax, Ross, and San Anselmo. Sanitary District No. 2 of Marin County owns and operates about 45 miles of sewer lines serving Corte Madera. San Rafael Sanitary District owns about 150 miles of sewer line serving San Rafael. The California Department of Corrections owns the collection system serving San Quentin Prison. And finally, Marin County owns the collection system serving San Quentin Village. Baykeeper commented that the satellite agencies should be named as dischargers in the permit. We named only Central Marin in the permit because it owns and operates the treatment plant that actually discharges to San Francisco Bay. In 2010, an Environmental Appeals Board determined that that US EPA did not establish basis to include satellites in a Massachusetts permit. Also, in 2006, the State Water Board concluded during adoption of its statewide general waste discharge requirements for wastewater collection systems, the idea of naming satellites in NPDES permits is not widely accepted. Based on this, and the fact that the satellite agencies are regulated by the general WDR, we recommend not naming the satellites. We did, however, revise the tasks related to blending to require Central Marin to increase its focus on improving the collection systems through cooperative efforts with its satellites. Baykeeper also commented that the monitoring frequency during blending is too relaxed to determine if effluent limits are being met, and that monitoring for each parameter should be required at least once per day during blending. We disagree. The monitoring requirements for blending events are contained in Attachment G of the permit, which are the regional standard provisions we include in all our permits. Daily monitoring for all parameters is unnecessary because many blending events are of short duration and some parameters are actually more dilute due to inflow and infiltration. Based on data from various dischargers within our region, total suspended solids is an appropriate surrogate for other possible pollutants. When total suspended solids have been below 45 milligrams per liter, dischargers have been in compliance with other effluent limitations. Total suspended solid concentrations above 45 milligrams per liter could indicate poor treatment, and violations of other effluent limitations could potentially occur. Therefore, we require daily TSS samples, and samples are to be retained during blending events. If the total suspended solids trigger is exceeded, we require monitoring of the retained samples. We revised the permit to require daily bacteria sampling during blending. This concludes my presentation, and I will now step aside and join my team, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Member McGrath.
Vincent, I've been puzzling over this one since I initially read it, and I'm curious as to whether or not the TSS concentrations times the volume of what's, you know, blended matters. And let me take you into my reasoning a little bit. I look pretty carefully at the tables on page F6 and F7, and it's a great advantage that you've got a 30 million gallon sewage treatment plant sitting there for 6 million gallons of daily flow. It's operating at about a fifth of what it's allowed to do. It's very clean. And that's roughly two billion gallons of well-treated effluent a year. And if you look at the average blended, it's about 100 million gallons a year. It's about 5%. So we've got something operating very, very efficiently, well below its standards, and then you've got something that's about a 5% incremental flow, and the question is what's the quality and the mass emissions associated with that and how much we should worry. That's what I'm thinking. Now, do we have data from the blending events that tell us that it's under 45 milligrams per liter suspended solids, even with the blending effluent?
Typically when the blending happens, suspended solids increases, and I think in 2010, I think it came out to 12. Is that right, Lila?
12.7.
12 points, yeah.
So even the blended effluent meets the secondary treatment requirement with with almost a 3-to-1 margin.
Yes, sir.
And it's 5% roughly of the overall flow.
Correct. By the way, I'm Lila Tang with the Water Board, and I took the oath. Yes, it's 12.7 on average. It's well below the standard. I think one of the highest values in 2010 was 23.
Do we have popping manholes and bypassing it into the streets in the system?
The upstream satellites are facing challenges with their systems that need a lot of rehabilitation.
So there's a real problem in terms of the collection system, but what makes it to the treatment system, even blended, meets secondary requirements by a substantial margin?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. That's very important.
That's what I understood.
I guess I missed the 12. Didn't read carefully enough.
Vice Chair?
Oh.
All right, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, I hope, a pretty simple clarification. It's on page 9 of the revised tentative order, item D. The second sentence says that we will determine compliance with the dry weather flow prohibition over 3 consecutive dry weather months each year. And I'm hoping there's somewhere else in the permit that identifies just how this is done. We obviously don't want people to just pick their favorite 3 dry consecutive months and figure that you know, that's a good compliance record.
Actually, I wouldn't characterize it that we let them pick their favorite months, but we do not specify exactly what those months are. I think in general, dry months are in Attachment G listed as May to September, and how we determine compliance with this is it will be based on the 3 driest months of any year. So sometimes with late spring storms, they may go from July, August, September. With late autumn rains, they might start in May, June, July, or they, you know, it has to be 3 consecutive months and during the dry. I mean, they could also choose the wet months if they really wanted to, but they typically won't.
So Part G specifies the 3 driest.
Part G gives a range for what dry weather is, and it ranges from May to September. which is 4 months, right? May, June, July, August.
Five months.
Yeah.
Okay.
The intent of that prohibition is that treatment plants are typically designed to handle a certain flow with, you know, contingencies in case this breaks, it still can handle that flow. So the reason for this is to make sure that they're not running their plant at max all the time. So typically, I think in the past, growth in the Bay Area hasn't really been as high as it was maybe a couple of decades ago. But in the past, I do recall in permits where it says, you know, if you're reaching like 85% of this capacity, then you need to give us a plan for how you, what are you going to do with the, what is the expected growth, and then what are you going to do about treating that growth. So really at this point, at this point for the Bay Area treatment plants, we're not really running up against capacity limits.
Okay, well, that explanation is useful. When I think of dry weather periods, I think of sometimes it goes from March to November, and it seemed like quite a wide range. But the fact that it's only is specified as being three consecutive out of those 5 months makes me more comfortable with the way that we have written this. The second item that I just want to check my information on, if you will, is that with the blending issue, we're really meshing two different vehicles. We're meshing this NPDES permit with the statewide WDRs on the collection systems and trying to make sure that they work together to achieve the goals that we want. Am I correct in assuming that the statewide general WDRs lack a specific task menu, specific reduction goals, specific timelines currently?
There are timelines, but more timelines to develop certain elements of system management plans and improvement plans.
So it's a timeline to develop a program, not a timeline to accomplish the objective of... Okay. That combined with the fact that we say in task number 4 in our table 8 of specific tasks to reduce blending, which comes on page 18, we've asked the permittee to determine whether it's contributing collection systems, whether they're making adequate progress, and it seems to me that I don't know right now what adequate progress is. So I will just kind of lay that out there, and perhaps at the end of the discussion today there will emerge a clearer picture than I have right now of who's going to determine what progress needs to be made in what kind of time period with these two vehicles put together. So I'll leave it at that for now, though.
Okay, with staff, we have a couple of cards here, so maybe we'll just start with the general manager, Jason Dow, please. And then... got the Jason team going here, but different viewpoints. Jason Flanders next. There he is.
Good morning, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk to you. My name is Jason Dow, and I'm the general manager of the Central Marin Sanitation Agency, also known as CMSA, and I've taken the oath to tell the truth today. I want to thank your staff, particularly Mr. Vince Christian, Mr. Bill Johnson, Ms. Lila Tang, for all the hard work that they did to renew our permit. I know it's a very involved and complex process. A lot of calculations, details, analyses, and revisions are done. Me and our agency appreciate your staff's willingness to discuss and consider our comments on the permit and their dedication in seeing the process through to completion and bringing the permit to you all today. So appreciate their hard work. The last time I spoke to you was at the... I was at your board meeting in April 2007 when you were considering the adoption of our current NPS permit. And during that discussion, I briefed you on our wet weather improvement program, which was a major capital endeavor that we started back in 2003. And at that hearing, I let you know that the design phase was completing in a couple months, and that we were about to, we had issued about $70 million in revenue bonds to fund the capital construction of the improvement program projects and other capital efforts over the years, and that construction would probably start in a few months, and that did happen in September of 2007. Well, those projects, and there were a series of them, and they were all completed a little over a year ago. In this past wet weather season, all those systems came online, and they were operated successfully. And what we constructed, just briefly, is we expanded the size of our effluent storage pond from 3 million gallons to 7 million gallons. We constructed a large wet weather pumping station to pump all the wet weather flows that were fully treated out to the San Francisco Bay to our discharge location. We built clarifiers, contact tanks, and made significant improvements to our secondary treatment process. And that was pretty significant because, as you heard in Mr. Christian's presentation, it was the agency was designed to have a 30 MGD secondary treatment process with everything else passively diverting around and being blended. But over the years, what had happened was that there was a lot of conservation in Central Marin, so our dry weather flows decreased, and the concentration of materials increased in the water that was coming to CMSA. So during this wet weather project, we did some process evaluations of that secondary system, and it was derated down to 20 MGD. So we included various improvements to that system to increase the rating back up to over 30 MGD. So that all happened, so now we're able to fully treat 30 MGD during the year before we blend. So that was an excellent part of the project. And the total cost of all those projects was about $54 million, which is pretty significant for an agency our size. So in terms of blending, these wet weather improvements also reduce the number of blending events per year, and they position the agency so that we can continue to meet our MPS permit effluent requirements when we do blend. And as Mr. Christian mentioned, that we haven't had a MPS permit exceedance in nearly 8 years. And we're about to receive the National Association of Clean Water Agencies 7-year Platinum Peak Performance Award for 100% compliance of those effluent requirements for the past 7 years in a row, which is wonderful news and excites all of our staff. And we also work collaboratively with our satellite collection agencies. We meet monthly with them in manager meetings, and we get information of what type of capital improvements they're making in their systems, what they've made, what they're planning to make. We have all of their 10-year CIPs, and currently they have completed in the last couple of years, or they'll be completing this year, upwards of $12 to $13 million of capital improvement projects, which are primarily focused on rehabilitation and replacement of the gravity sewer systems within their collective areas, which you know will reduce INI, which then will reduce blending at the agency during the wet weather storm events. Our agency is also, you know, pretty proud of our successful pollution prevention program, for which back in 2009 we were awarded the Regional Water Board's Dr. Chang Chung Wu Award, and then in 2010 we received the CWEA Statewide Pollution Prevention Award. And what we did is we established, and now we lead, a countywide cooperative pollution prevention program that has a lot of different elements to it. But to highlight a few, we have a elementary school program where we hire jugglers and puppeteers, and they go into elementary schools within, you know, all throughout the county, and it's called Go With The Flow, and they teach children from kindergarten to fifth grade, you know, about water issues, wastewater issues, and essentially what not to throw down the drain. So we hope that they take that information home and share it with their folks. We also have public outreach booths that we set up, and our staff and the other agency staffs attend at various public events throughout the county, from the Marin County Fair to EcoFest to Earth Days to Wetland Days to farmers markets and other events, where we educate the public about water, wastewater, environmental issues. We have a pretty well-received environmental quiz for kids and for adults. And if they get 100% on the quiz, which has questions about current issues of wastewater concern, we have, you know, kind of fun promotional items we give them and stuff. Some kids have, like, collections from, like, 5 years ago to, say, all the different shirts and little things we have and stuffed animals. It's pretty cool to see. We also give a lot of tours of our treatment plant to interested members of the public. And a lot of those are to high school and college students that are taking classes in the environmental sciences. And we also sponsor, you know, environmental messages, information for inclusion in calendars and different publications published by the county and in the school districts throughout the county. So that's been pretty successful. A couple of the highlights from our pollution prevention side is that the 399 food service establishments within Central Marin County are in full compliance with our fats, oils, and grease program. And you all know the benefit of that is it reduces the amount and the volume of sewer overflows in the collection system. So that's been really successful over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years since we implemented it. And also more recently, the 132 dental offices within our service area are in full compliance with our mercury reduction ordinance. And that's an ordinance that was passed by our board to comply with the Regional Water Board's mercury watershed permit. And with all those dental offices being in compliance, that's reducing the mercury loading to the plant and to the receiving waters, the central San Francisco Bay. So that's excellent news also. And then lastly, we have a new facility that will be starting up probably in the fall, and that's a fats, oils, and grease and commercial food waste facility where private haulers will bring that fog material, and the local solid waste company, Marin Sanitary Service, will be bringing commercial food waste to our agency. We'll process that, send the material to our digesters, produce more biogas, use that in our cogeneration system, and we'll decrease our dependency on natural gas and electricity, reducing the greenhouse gas, you know, footprint of kind of Central Marin area, and has a lot of other environmental benefits. So we're looking forward to that, with the ultimate goal at some point in the future is that our agency becomes 100% energy self-sufficient and we can start exporting electricity that we produce to the utility grid. And then in closing, I'd just like to say our staff and the agency on our board are very committed to providing cost-effective wastewater services to the customers in our service area and to the customers in Marin, where we have a lot of the contracts that we provide services. And we appreciate your consideration of our permit, and thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well said. Next, Jason, please. The other Jason, Flanders. With Baykeepers.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Jason Flanders. Good morning. My name is Jason Flanders at San Francisco Baykeeper, and I want to thank you all for your very careful consideration of this permit. I do want to echo the theme of our comment letter and that of USEPA's that, you know, we urge the board to do more to reduce blending here at this plant and also just as a policy matter region-wide. The first minor point is that we do agree with EPA that the feasibility analysis for these blending requests should be posted with the permit for the full duration of the public comment period. We got that kind of late. I understand that it was available at any time we had requested, but it's such a key document and such a technical document that you know, we agree with EPA that the full 30 days to review that would be warranted. So as you know, the blending, it's a bypass of Clean Water Act regulations that can only be permitted in advance if the permittee shows that at this time there are no feasible alternatives to the bypass. Well, we really sincerely commend CMSA for all of its prior work. The feasibility analysis has to be forward-looking, and the feasibility utility analysis that was part of this permit application doesn't meet this significant burden in our view. First, it admits that the data it uses are, quote, outdated, not showing the more recent data of improvements that have occurred due to its recent work. One would hope that with the recent wet weather improvements and with the recent improvements of the satellite collection systems, the INI, and the need for blending would be less, thereby increasing the feasibility of removing the need for blending or reducing the need for blending in this permit. But without that updated information, we have no way of knowing that. Also, the analysis doesn't really include an analysis of cost feasibility. It includes cost estimates of expanded storage and expanded secondary treatment, and it says those costs would be difficult, but we know difficulty is not synonymous with feasibility. Most things in our field are difficult, even if they are feasible. But we also know that the big source of this issue is systemic, and it comes from inflow and infiltration in the collection systems, and therefore we have urged the regional board to require MPDES coverage in the collection systems, as you have done with the East Bay satellite dischargers, I think in a very effective way. The discharge of the blended wastewater is, in the first instance, not legal under the Clean Water Act, subject to your grant of an exception based on the feasibility showing in the permit application. And so far as we don't believe that feasibility showing has been made, and that it's wholly within the board's discretion to note that the excess INI from the collection systems, in fact, causes and contributes to these blended discharges, and therefore the collection systems should be brought under permit coverage. Second, you can look in CWICS and see that the collection systems have regularly reported unpermitted discharges to waters, which is essentially the hallmark of the need for an NPDES permit. And also, Dr. Young had asked about kind of the difference between how they're regulated under the WDR regime versus what we would get through NPDES permitting. And I think the biggest difference is public participation. The Clean Water Act has a bit of a higher standard for public comment, public enforcement, and really just the involvement of the public. And we've seen other collection systems that have unpermitted discharges to waters without NPDES coverage kind of use the WDR as a shield, say, well, we're following the process of the WDR, so you can't say that we're in violation of the Clean Water Act. That concludes my comments. In sum, we just urge the regional board to take a more proactive approach to reducing blending in our region and requiring more timely and more robust feasibility analyses and more direct involvement with the satellite agencies. Thank you.
I have a question. Thank you, Jason. Dr. Singh.
I was reading some of the questions raised in your letter to the water board. And for some reason, I didn't like the language. Okay. It was nice to request that this should be changed or this should be, and they have made compromises in response to your request in monitoring and things like that. But just use the word must, and I didn't like that. Seems like must is a very strong word. The regional board must issue NPDES permits of satellite collection systems. The minimum flow requirement prior to discharge must be increased rather than should be increased or right. Request to increase. Why do you use such a strong language, something like with some authority?
Sure. I appreciate you bring that to our attention. I think it's not intended to be overly pushy or aggressive, but intended to simply reflect absolute requirements of the law. Where there's discretion in the law, we would use the language, I'm a lawyer by training, so we would use the language, you should do this, you should exercise your discretion in this fashion. If we believe under our reading of the law that there's not room for an exercise of discretion, it's simply a legal interpretation that this must be done under the law. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
It's a good lawyer answer.
I have a lot of questions. A lot of questions on this issue, but let some other people discuss that. Speaking right now.
Yep. Board Member.
My throat is not cooperating with me.
I would like to ask our legal staff. As Dr. Young said, we're trying to blend the regulation of the sewage treatment plant and whether or not they've done all that reasonably can be expected to them, and the question of how we must or should regulate the collection systems. So I guess my question is if all the wastewater that's collected is contained within the pipes and comes down to the sewage treatment plant system, even with the blending system, we have something that technically meets the requirements of secondary treatment. So in terms of what the bay sees from the outfall, it's pretty good. It doesn't just meet the requirements. It's well under the requirements. And I see $54 million worth of improvements, not all of which went to better treatment of that, but which effectively does that. On the other hand, if not all of the material stays in the pipes and then it is discharged to waters of the state of California, and perhaps it's no longer a matter of regulating wastewater collection systems in that manner, but in fact the argument could be made that they should get a permit for that. Where does the law figure on this? Do we have authority, discretion, or strong encouragement to regulate the sanitary sewer systems, the collection systems, with different mechanisms that we are facing with the sewage treatment plant?
This is a complex question, and we did have quite a bit of discussion about it this week. your question kind of boils down to whether or not to pull in the collection systems. A POTW is defined as including the collection system. So in theory, you could include them in an NPDES permit. Now, all that said, it hasn't been done successfully. So there are varying discussions about whether or not to do a similar NPDES permit the way the East Bay collection systems were included. And I'm going to have to let staff speak to that because I know there's some factual differences between that situation and this situation. So it kind of boils down to the level of risk that this particular board wants to pursue in terms of adding collection systems to this permit. That would require, of course, going back, revising the permit, going out for another public comment period if you choose to go that direction. But ultimately, the question of can it be done is not something that's really been tested. Theoretically, you could under this concept of POTWs, including the collection system.
Let me see if I can focus my question a little
Jason, bit. You could stand down.
And sharpen the inquiry. I think there's a factual question that I'm not sure of one way or the other. I don't know we've been developed, but if, in fact, one of the three collection systems has a spill to the waters, then I would wonder what our enforcement mechanisms are, not limited to just merely an NPDES permit, which may be an unwieldy instrument for the task at hand. But what we want to do, what I agree with the commentary on, is that we need to be sure that if there's in fact discharge of raw sewage to the waters of the state, we want to see reasonable progress made on that. And this, I'm convinced that this sewage treatment plant is not perhaps the optimum tool, but what tools are there that we could use?
Staff, do you want to help out the legal team there a little bit?
Well, I think we all have a variety of answers here. I think you've hit on it because we are making a distinction here between the blending, where that blending has not resulted in violation of effluent limitations. And as you note, the quality is quite good, and as Jason Dow pointed out, they have not had a violation in 8 years, which is highly commendable. The flip side being that when there are sanitary sewer overflows, we are going to aggressively enforce those. In fact, in this case, there is a pending action on the Ross Valley Sanitation District, and our options are many. In the East Bay communities, we have gone through for essentially 30 years an effort to address those, both the SSOs from the East Bay communities and the overflows at the wet weather structures that have been constructed to provide that relief in the system. The difference for the East Bay communities is that those overflows at those wet weather facilities do not meet secondary standards, and that we have the consent decrees established that will either reduce or eliminate any discharge from those wet weather facilities or ensure that they meet secondary standards, and that work's still underway. I think one parallel here is that what we have done on the peninsula for San Mateo, Crystal Springs Sanitary, Hillsborough, is not only enforced on their SSOs, but recognize there's a lot of work that needs to be done to bring those up to a certain standard. And in so doing, we have brought to you, and you've adopted cleanup cease and desist orders in those cases, which sure. spell out a number of tasks with a rigorous schedule for them to do so. On the flip side, even though we've issued, for instance, Crystal Springs and Sanitary District a cease and desist order, we have not issued them an NPDES permit.
So Bruce, I think you've indicated that we have discretion and authority under the enforcement side of our house to take what action we believe is necessary. And I'd like to return to the council just for a minute and make sure that we actually, as a board, I think here have a policy choice. We have the option, as urged by the Baykeeper, to make this an NPDES permit, which has a certain level of risk. But if we believe as a board that we have sufficient tool in another arena that doesn't entail that risk, we have the discretion to go in that direction. Is that... I want to make sure that we're not doing something that we must. That we're doing something that we have the discretion to choose the appropriate tool. A screwdriver for a screw, a wrench for... Not always a hammer.
Right, and as I said before, the question of whether you can add the collection agencies to the NPDES permit is not something that has been tested. So in theory, you certainly could go that direction. And as you say, you have other options. Bruce has mentioned cease and desist orders. There's other enforcement tools that can be used in the event of SSOs or other issues with the collection systems to ensure that they are also
okay.
In line with the law.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yuri?
And I'll just add that when the State Board adopted the statewide general permit for the collection systems, they really carefully considered the issue of whether, you know, they should regulate the collection systems through an NPDES permit or a waste discharge requirement, and they concluded that, you know, the waste discharge requirements would be better because the universe of potential discharges would be larger under WDRs as opposed to NPDES. For example, you know, there was a case that said that, you know, the boards cannot regulate potential discharges, and you know, these sewer overflows from collection systems arguably are potential discharges. So this issue was considered by the State Board, and the State Board decided WDRs were the way to go.
Vice Chair.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one little thing. Obviously, we all want to decrease sanitary sewer overflows. It's my understanding that the Clean Water Act also directs us to reduce blending events. And I don't know whether that's a must or a should, but the Clean Water Act definitely says blending events are a problem, even when secondary standards are met. So I don't want the discussion of the board today to leave the impression that we have somehow mistakenly concluded that blending is not a problem when the standards are met.
This goes to EPA policy development, that they have put out a draft policy in 2005, which they have never finalized. And we don't disagree with the need to continue to ratchet down on blending, but we're not saying it's an absolute that needs to be spelled out in a fashion that we need to, for instance, put together a cease and desist order as to how they're going to reduce or eliminate blending in the next 5 years. We feel that by having Table 8, the tasks that are going to push the reduction of blending, and at the same time continuing to push on the collection system agencies to reduce their infiltration, which de facto then reduces the need for blending, and combined with recognizing that Central Marin has just completed very significant work at their plant, and that we're still trying to get a good understanding of what that means in addressing the blending. We're trying to push this recognizing we always have the tools, as we've described, to go back and look at spill events, but that we're saying that in this case, the permit for Central Marin should be specific to Central Marin. Continue to look at ways to reduce blending. We do have the chance to come back in 5 years to say, okay, we've looked at what you've done. Maybe it's not rigorous enough, or maybe it's addressed. So we've got an opportunity to apply, as Jim says, hopefully the screwdriver for the screws and wrench for, you know, the appropriate situation. And we're saying that naming all of the satellite agencies here is really not the appropriate tool.
And just to clarify on the blending issue, the Clean Water Act doesn't speak to blending. It does speak to bypass. And so bypass is prohibited unless certain circumstances exist. And the board staff has made the case that the bypass here is unavoidable and there are no feasible alternatives to the bypass. Thank you.
Board Member McGrath, comment?
You know, as you probably can tell when I ask questions about what the so what of this, it really matters what quality is being discharged in terms of the mass emissions that the bay sees from wherever it sees it. An overflow is a different matter because there's public health implications. It may not reach the bay, but it may do damage upstream. I'm going to support the staff recommendation, and I note in particular the comments that Bruce made in his June 6 memo that there is $16 million in sewer rehabilitation and there is the problem of 50% of the leaking pipes. At the same time, I would like to support the Baykeeper's request that feasibility analysis be posted and that there be a little more rigorous debate on the questions of feasibility, and that's for reasons of equity. You know, I did a little quick math looking at the amount of money that Central Marin has put into their system, and it's nearly $500 per capita. That's not chump change. 50% of the lateral replacement is going to cost you about $3,000. I do have some equity concerns about all the ratepayers in a sanitary system providing downstream capacity because someone upstream won't fix their lateral. That doesn't mean we have necessarily the tool to fix it, but it does mean, I think, that a discussion of feasibility in the larger context, is it really cheaper for all the ratepayers to deal with it downstream or upstream? I mean, I think that's a healthy debate, and I think public participation in that debate does help. So I do think there's enough in there in terms of a list of activities that are required. I do think that there's a start. There isn't much rigor that I can see before us that says whether or not that $16 million will be sufficient. And in the real world, we do rely on entities like the Baykeeper to help keep the discharger's feet to the fire. So I think there's enough in there, but I would also like the staff to be sensitive to the public policy benefits of having that feasibility debate in a larger context. I do think Central Sand has done what we can reasonably expect of it.
And Central Marin.
Central Marin, I'm sorry. And Central Marin, and achieved very good performance. And for that reason, I think the staff's recommendation is sufficiently protective.
Well, I'm satisfied that the blended material meet all the requirements as for secondary. And I would approve the order.
You know, if I'm permitted by the chair, so I'd like to say a few words here. I understand the sentiment of the Baykeepers, also my friend Jim McGrath. What I'm amazed that if there is excess water coming, I don't know what is the limit of water. I guess we're looking at extreme probability or that under no circumstance the blending should take place, even in extreme events. What could be the alternative? Either, as long as the quality of effluent meets the requirement of the water quality standard, why should we gripe there? We're putting the requirement that water quality should meet the certain standard. And if that standard is being met, I know it is a nice goal to reduce the infiltration and inflows, and I'm very sure that Central Marine Sanitation District will get together with their satellites. We should encourage them, I talk to them, and develop some program over the next 5 years that how to reduce ionize. But looking for alternative to what we can do, there is only one alternative. Either you discharge it, if there is a lot of water coming down, or you store it somewhere. You need a lot of land, a lot of underground storage facilities. There are problems with that too. And then release it over a time. It depends on what quantity of water is coming. And marine, in this area, is the highest. It received the highest amount of rain, I think, of the Bay Area, as far as we know. It's heavily rainfall amounts over there is higher, even if it is a drought over here. Or you blend it and let it go to the... What else can you do? I don't know what else you can do. You can flood certain portion of the... A lot of extra land is available. Create a storage. So alternatives are rather limited as far as I can see it. Maybe you guys have some other ideas. You can have some temporary storage. There is a cost to that. Land storage facilities has to be created. The investment is needed. You have to purchase or you have to blend it. But why I think that this is what the staff has done over here, I agree with them in one respect, that the final product is going into the bay. They require that to meet the water quality standard, even after blending. This is not that anything can mix and let it go in the bay. And at the same time, they are also encouraging the central to take the responsibility of the sanitation district and coordinate with the satellites rather than they taking charge and monitoring from here, from Water Quality Board. And I don't know how many tasks you want to assign to our staff to take care of. And I think they are already overloaded and underpaid as far as I am concerned. So, thank you.
Dr. Young?
Yes, I'm going to support the staff's recommendation, but I have some qualms about it, and I'll lay those out. The part that does not give me qualms is that I appreciate the very good compliance record for the Central Marin System, the fact that even during the blending discharges, that the discharges meet standards. It is important, as Jim says, to look at what's happening in the water, what the water quality sees. And I also appreciate the fairly aggressive investments that you've made in the last permit cycle. So for all those reasons, I'm comfortable with the staff's decision to use the two tools that it has at hand, the NPDES permit and the statewide WDRs, in a way that gives the Central Marin the responsibilities that we feel are appropriate to it and under its control right now, and then focuses on the collection systems, on the WDRs, to try to address the inflow and infiltration problem. I think that the specific tasks that we have to reduce blending in Table 8 fall a little bit short. One item that I will draw to everyone's attention that I think is actually very good is Item 5 that requires the permittee to consider flow-based rate structures in my worldview, that's the magic answer, one of the magic answers to this problem. And I understand that we can't require it, but requiring them to develop a proposal to look at, I think, is a very smart thing to do and very appropriate. What I am still bothered by the idea that we are, in this permit, in Item 4, saying
go out and work with your collection systems, and if you don't think it's adequate, you know, work with them to do something else. And then we're also saying, well, we're going to work with the WDRs to try to solve the inflow and infiltration problem. But it's all kind of in a trust us mode. You know, people, the rest of the members of the public and even the board members, you know, we sort of don't know how this is going to be implemented and how effective it's going to be. So my request of the staff would be to find a way during this permit cycle, before 2017, to come up with some specific goals that the collection systems can use as targets, and that everybody's on the same page with, that those are our targets of percentage reductions in INI or completion of certain tasks and timelines for those, because this lack of specificity and the idea that, well, we're just going to do it over there in some other forum troubles me. So that would be my request to staff, and I am going to vote in favor of the recommendation to adopt the permit, because everything else in here I think is very good.
Those are great comments by all the presenters, too, and staff. Just try to quick summarize. I think it sounds really easy. I'm trying to be practical here in this wastewater world. How do we convince that stepchild upstream to come on board and do the right things? And it's not easy. You know, those regions out there have a different feeling on collections, at the end product, we're still not doing damage at the treatment plant going out, and they're winning awards and doing good things, but yet we're trying to squeeze them a little harder here to include those stepchildren out there, yeah, with all respect to them. And I think, the way the investment world is going and funding, I don't know how in the heck we're going to catch up with all of that too right now. It's going to be a very, very challenging time for people, and it's not like state and federal governments are going to be stepping up and pushing out more funding and bond money to try to do the right things out there. But the main thing is, I don't think we've damaged the water quality going into our bay, and I think that's very important. And also, we do still have the authority, as I understand it, that we can go back to those collection agencies and put cease and desist on them and say, hey, you know what, you guys got to do something here, you're goofing up. And I know it's real easy for us to encourage that permit to go back to the collection guys and say, you know what, you got to get on board. And I agree, how do we balance out the cost of this whole thing with everyone out there? And, we as a community have been in trying to increase our wastewater rates, and you think we're asking for the firstborn child, you know what I mean? And then we're talking $30 or so a month, and let me tell you, that handle doesn't work in the morning, you're sure as hell going to pay an extra $30. So I think we're on the right track. You've had good input from these board members that are stating, really, how do we squeeze it down a little tighter. I kind of almost look at the collection and the treatment thing almost like what we're doing as ratepayers out there, or taxpayers, on our vehicle and our highway taxes, that we're all getting more and more miles on electric cars and everything else, and yet the person that's buying gasoline is paying a bigger share of that highway taxes, and we're not getting the money we need to do in there. And it's almost sort of like what collection people are doing out there to the treatment plants, and that's kind of the way I look at it. So I think staff definitely heard, and legal counsel, thank you for your great support on this, because it does come down to the laws, too, on how do we enforce these things and make sure that we're moving forward. So I would ask for staff's recommendation, which we're hearing, in support motion from the board.
Well, and let me make a comment as part of the staff recommendation. I do hear, as Jim says, we should make sure that we're being transparent, and as Baykeepers pointed out, putting the utility analysis posted for review Likewise, both Baykeeper and USEPA made comments about how rigorous that utility analysis was and whether it was sufficiently rigorous. That certainly the comments they provided will direct us moving forward, although I think in this instance I don't think the final conclusion from the utility analysis would have been much different if all of those additional steps were spelled out. I think moving forward, we have over the coming five-year permit cycle an opportunity, as Terry says, to come up with some more specific goals. But I think also during that period, we're going to have the example of the efforts that the East Bay communities are going to need to take on a much more significant wet weather issue, and that will not only potentially drive what in future permit cycles we do for Central Marin, but many other permittees around the Bay. I did have the opportunity a couple weeks ago to have a 6 or 8 minute discussion with the governor over water quality issues in our region and focused on the wet weather issue. And after describing this, and he wondered what's a lateral, and I explained to him what a sewer lateral was. And at the end of it, he said, sounds expensive. Yes. It is. It's expensive, and it's going to be a challenge. And as John has pointed out, that ratepayers, whether or not they've had to pay it in the past, they certainly don't want to pay it now. And so this is the ongoing challenge: is how do we balance availability of funds with comprehensive solutions to the fact that there's too much water in the wrong place at the wrong time? And so how can we address that moving forward? And I think we have an opportunity to look at this more regionally, somewhat driven by the efforts that are being done in the East Bay, but that we don't want to take a sort of a shotgun approach and saying, well, gee, here's Central Marin in front of us, let's name everybody. We don't think that's going to be efficient. So we are going to be looking at more of a region-wide approach to this. We already have the statewide general WDRs, which provide sort of a foundation that rightfully focuses much more on sanitary sewer overflows rather than blending, but there is that connection. So the more we're able to reduce inflow infiltration, the better we are able to control this, both at places where it might come out of the manhole or overwhelm the treatment plant. And so this is going to be a challenge moving forward, and we want to be able to pull in efforts such as what San Francisco PUC is promoting through efforts such as gray water reuse and a number of initiatives here. It's not just looking only at something that can be done rigorous through the permitting. So there's a number of options, and we'll keep the board informed as we move forward on this. So with that, I'd recommend adoption of the revised tentative order you have in front of you.
I'd so move.
Second.
I said, okay.
It's moved in second. And just a little housekeeping, may I suggest if we have a permit like this coming again soon, it might be good to have the collection agencies in the audience, too, to hear what we're saying, just as a suggestion. I don't even know if it's feasible, but I think they ought to be listening to what these treatment people are going through. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah, I think that's a good point.
Other than that's just my little two-bit suggestion. So,
and just as a comment, I have confidence that in our staff that understand, and thanks to the participation of the Baykeeper, the importance of being proactive on infiltration and inflow. And I think Bruce's comments about where it is likely to be addressed, we may seek more tools, and we would have to do that with the cooperative understanding. But I'm pretty sure that if the owners of the collection systems realize the authority of the regional board under WDRs and our staff use their collaborative skills, that we'll make progress on this.
Let me add one more comment before we vote over here. You know, one thing I see a pattern over here. Every time any permit comes up for renewal, we see the slight change in the language, a slight improvement every time. And certainly, I'm very sure one time, I think John Mueller, our great chair, made a comment that over a period of time, with a lot of pinch, a lot of hurt, we have made great strides in improving the water quality of the region. And every time we go through the cycle, it happens. But there are improvements, and there are language changes, and there is a more ask for. One thing I like that the sanitation district should invite the representative from the collection agencies, so they should hear the comment, what's happening. And I'm very sure that you will inform them that what happened over here and what was the gripe. And I think the baykeeper also, I thank you for bringing some of the significant points, even though you might think that you lost the battle, but you really did not lose the battle. Your points were taken care of over here, and we discussed them at length. And it will have a future impact in future, but we have to go gradually. We just can't ask every taxpayer in this time of recession to pay $1,000 for a household. They can't afford it. Yep. Everybody will go broke. So we have to balance the whole process.
We must vote now.
Thank you.
Roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliyahu.
Aye.
Mr. McGrath.
Aye.
Dr.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So ordered. So thank all of you there. At this time, really and truly, we do, Shell, please, we need a quick break.
And, I think so.
On to item 7. The Vice Chair and I were just commenting. We're talking about flows. I think we got more airflow in here. That's not good. We feel like Saturday Night Live or something where they keep it really cool. Where all these TV shows, don't they keep it freezing in there or something? I'm going to have to put this jacket
down.
Yes. State's getting their $100 worth out of us today, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So, no laugh. You guys still get paid.
Wait, is that going to be 95 now, or are we exempt?
Oh, that's right. Do we get the cut, too? I still want to go. I want to go for that 500. I might stick around for that one. All right.
So, item 7 is consideration of the reissuance of NPDES permit for the Shell Oil Products Shell Martinez refinery. Like Robert Schlitz to make the staff presentation.
Okay, good morning, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. My name is Robert Schliff. I'm an engineer in the NPDES Wastewater Control Division. The permit before you today is for the Shell Martinez refinery to discharge about 5.8 million gallons per day of treated wastewater and industrial stormwater runoff to Carquinez Strait. I'll first briefly describe the facility and the treatment processes, and then cover the issues that Baykeeper has indicated it will provide testimony on today. So this is an aerial view of the refinery. Highway 680 is located here just to the east, and the city of Martinez is located to the west. This yellow line demarcates the refinery boundaries, and this area here in the northwest corner is the wastewater treatment plant, and the discharge point is located here about 500 feet offshore. Shell's treatment system consists first of oil water separators, followed by biological treatment, similar to that used at municipal wastewater treatment plants. The wastewater is further treated to remove selenium with the units shown in this slide. Shell adds ferric chloride to bind solids together to form a flock, which contains most of the selenium. The flock separates out in these yellow circular units shown here. From selenium removal, Shell routes the wastewater to granular activated carbon units for final polishing before discharge. And while we resolved many comments on this draft permit, the San Francisco Baykeeper has indicated that they are not satisfied with our responses on two issues. First, Baykeeper believes it is inappropriate to use data from a far-field background station to derive effluent limits. And second, Baykeeper believes a quantitative reasonable potential analysis for stormwater runoff is necessary. Now, before I discuss the first issue, I wanted to provide some background on how we determine initial dilution, because this plays a role in how we derive effluent limits. As a reminder, initial dilution is a zone where rapid mixing occurs between the discharge and the receiving water until the discharge has lost most of its momentum. While the discharge will continue to disperse and become more dilute, this slower dilution is not considered initial dilution. And the main forces that drive initial dilution are the momentum of the discharge, the spacing of the ports on the diffuser, the buoyancy of the discharge relative to a saltier receiving water, and receiving water currents. And to determine initial dilution, in 1987, Shell used a dye tracer added to the actual discharge during slack tide. And slack tide results in the lowest, most conservative measurement of initial dilution, particularly since the currents in Carquinez Strait are very strong. And Shell's diffuser was the same then as it is today. It's still at the bottom of Carquinez Strait, about 20 feet below the water surface, and it still has 20 ports along the last 60 feet of outfall pipe. And this means that the dispersion characteristics have not changed. And in 2001, Shell validated the conservatism of the 1987 study by modeling with USEPA's visual plumes. And the modeling showed an initial dilution of almost twice that measured in the dye tracer study. So what all this means is that the dilution restrictions placed in the tentative order are very conservative. Now, on Baykeeper's first issue of the inappropriate use of a far-field background station, I want to first point out that our proposed approach results in protective limits. This approach is a bay-wide give-and-take approach. We propose to give with a far-field cleaner station, which then provides us a basis to take back with a restrictive dilution credit. And as shown in our response to comments, the limits are all more stringent except for one using this bay-wide approach versus a discharge-by-discharge approach, as Baykeeper suggests. And in the one exception, the limit would only be marginally less stringent. And this bay-wide approach is allowed by and consistent with state policy. Specifically, state policy states that when the Water Board establishes ambient conditions, it can do so on a discharge-by-discharge or a water body-by-water body basis. On the second issue about the need for a quantitative reasonable potential analysis for stormwater runoff discharges, I want to point out that recent court rulings do not support this approach, nor is such a quantitative analysis done for other industrial runoff discharges. For Shell stormwater discharges, we relied upon a qualitative analysis and did not find that stormwater runoff would pose a reasonable potential to cause or contribute to water quality impairment. First, Shell routes runoff from areas with the highest potential for contamination to its wastewater treatment plant. Then, for other areas, the runoff goes through physical settling of solids, as shown in this slide, and is visually inspected for sheen or color prior to discharge. Also, as a preventative measure, Shell is required to store waste materials in a way that would not allow for exposure to stormwater. Even so, as a check, the tentative order would require priority pollutant monitoring at a select discharge point. And this is the discharge point that contains the most solids, since many pollutants associate with solids. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Board Member McGrath.
Thank you, Robert. I was curious about one aspect of this. As noted, there were some violations and some improvements made to it. In addition, on table, on the table that shows the performance, the actual discharge limits are established in pounds per day, 1839 for BOD, and you've got a highest month average of 2166, and then explanation that included some other material which had an allowance, and therefore it met it. But what I'm curious is if there's a average monthly average to compare to the monthly average to see is there much headroom between how they're performing and what their limits are, and in particular what the benefits of the process improvements that they've made. If you can't ask that, that's kind of a warning to the applicant to be able to kind of give us information on that.
I think there is. It's not in this table, but they are well below their limits typically for like BOD and suspended solids. Because what you're seeing here, the highest monthly average is sometimes the same as the highest daily discharge because they only collect one sample per month. But the improvements they made are really specific to selenium. They had about 20 violations in February of 2008, right. And then during 2008, that's when they made a lot of improvements.
And there's also a new unit that's going to be brought online because they have to take one of theirs down for. So that would give them additional capacity, or would they keep one of those offline?
It gives them additional capacity, but I think they probably keep one of them offline. You'd have to ask them about that.
Okay. You know. Thank you.
You're comfortable with staff right now? Okay, we will move on. Thank you. With staff, just stand by.
Okay.
We'll move on.
Listen to beekeeper here.
Pardon me?
There is a testimony on this one.
Please. Yes, we okay. Steve, we'll get the manager for Shell Refinery Sustainable. And Abigail, you'll follow wherever you are.
Good morning. I'm Steve Lesher. I'm the Manager of Sustainable Development and Public Affairs for the Shell Refinery. I sit on the refinery's leadership team. I'm very happy to be here with you this morning, and I appreciate your consideration. Obviously, we're here to ask you to support the renewal of our MPDES permit. As a refiner in the Bay Area, we're very conscious of the fact that we're operating under the strictest environmental standards in the world, and that's something that we actually embrace, and we hope to always meet those standards, if not exceed them, and we understand the expectations of our regulators and our neighbors. We believe the permit proposal before you represents that, and with respect to our environmental performance, I would just say that you know, what we do with water, how we use water, and how we treat water, there's really almost nothing more important than that in terms of our environmental performance, and we're very conscious of that. Doing that and doing that well is a real point of pride for the people at our facility, several of whom are here today. We appreciate the issues related to the permit that have been raised and the opportunity to work with staff to address those. We didn't get everything we wanted in the permit process, but we think the permit before you represents something that's not only strong and strict, but also consistent with the other refineries that you've granted the permit renewals to. So, again, I would just ask you that you renew that permit and know that it's critical to our ongoing operations and for being viable into the future. And, again, I'd acknowledge the several personnel we have here from Shell today who work with our water treatment systems, have input on the design of those systems, and have worked extensively on this permit. And we're happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Abigail, please.
Good morning. There we go. That's better. Good morning. My name is Abigail Blodgett, legal fellow at San Francisco Baykeeper, and I'm here to express Baykeeper's main concerns with the draft permit for the Shell oil refinery. Our first concern is related to the board's reliance on ambient background data from the far-field RMP monitoring station to calculate the permittee's effluent limitations. To determine the appropriate effluent limits for the Shell refinery, the board uses data from Yerba Buena Island, which is located 27 miles downstream from the permittee's outfall in the Carquinez Strait. Given all that we know about the complexities of the San Francisco estuary, samples collected at the Yerba Buena Island cannot be representative of the conditions at the Shell's outfall in the strait. Also, Mr. Schlipp mentioned calculating effluent limits using a different monitoring station in his presentation, and this station is in a creek, which we believe also would not be representative of conditions in Carquinez Strait. We believe that calculating effluent limits using this kind of data is contrary to the state implementation plan, which asks the board to give priority to ambient background concentrations that are measured in close proximity to discharges. We understand that the board has to make a decision on the permit and that the existing RMP sites near the Shell refinery may not be sufficient to conduct an adequate reasonable potential analysis. But this should not prevent the board from requiring a major industrial facility like Shell to conduct sufficient monitoring of receiving waters at their outfall. In the future, we hope that the RMP would modify its program to better capture the range of conditions in the bay and to effectively represent the waters near major industrial facilities and their outfalls. Second, we are concerned by the limited monitoring requirements for Shell stormwater discharges. The draft permit only requires Shell to test for priority pollutants at discharge point 4, even though there is a serious potential for contamination at other stormwater outfalls. For example, Shell reported several spills of toxic materials within the watershed of discharge point 2, where significant industrial activities occur. Even more, Shell routes only the first flush of stormwater from discharge point 2 to its treatment plant, even though there's ample research showing that stormwater pollution is not confined to the first flush event, which is not even defined in this permit. The response to comments cites draft of the divers environmental case to justify not requiring additional monitoring, but I just want to distinguish the situation because unlike the situation in divers environmental, where there was a thorough regional board stormwater study, in lieu of priority pollutant monitoring, there is no way to confirm in this case that Shell's stormwater complies with water quality standards. The statewide general permit for industrial stormwater discharges requires permittees to analyze stormwater samples for toxic pollutants that may be present in significant quantities, and this logic should be applied to the Shell's discharges to at least require stormwater monitoring for pollutants that are likely to come from this complex facility, such as metals and PAHs. This change would be consistent with the recently adopted MPDES permit for the Chevron refinery, where the board staff revised the permit to include similar stormwater monitoring in response to our comments. Finally, we submitted comments stating that limits for selenium and mercury under the California Toxics Rule are not protective of endangered species, as discussed in the United States Fish and Wildlife Service's biological opinion for the CTR. But the draft permit continues to rely on the CTR without any real investigation into the refinery's impacts on endangered salmonids. We just urge the board going forward to take a more careful look at how heavy industry in San Pablo Bay and the Carquinez Strait may be harming these fish populations. Thank you very much for your time
and
consideration.
Thank you for your presentation. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Otherwise, Craig Johns. And that's the last card I have on this item.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Craig Johns. I'm here today on behalf of the Partnership for Sound Science and Environmental Policy as the project manager. I want to thank the board staff for its very consistently excellent work on all of these permits. Mr. Schliff and his supervisors have done, again, a very, very good job with a very difficult set of data for an industrial facility. You know, we heard the comments from Baykeeper relative to the 2 points. I think I don't want to belabor the points or the responses. Mr. Schliff did an excellent job, I think, in responding to those in his staff presentation, as well as in the response to comments that were presented in your materials that were available to the public. There was nothing that I heard from Ms. Blodgett today that either contradicts really any of the points that Mr. Schliff made. If there's a question as far as the legal requirements related to the specific case that was referenced in both Mr. Schliff's presentation as well as Ms. Blodgett's comments here, perhaps staff counsel at your discretion and request can respond to that. But this is the effort of staff and the discharger's representatives in working out a very difficult permit over the course of several months, and this is really no different approach than this staff, the board has taken really in any other permits that is issued for the refineries in the Bay Area, and PSEP would respectfully urge your approval and vote aye on this permit today. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Board members?
Can I start with a discussion over here?
Yes, sir.
I was just curious that this 25-year-old dilution study was not done for the last 25 years. Now you have asked them before next permit cycle to come back with a new dilution study. Why it was not done a few more times? What was the reason?
The practice no longer is to use dyes, first of all. So the dye study was performed in 1987. That was sort of the state of the art at that time. There was a modeling study done in 2001, which showed that they actually achieved a higher dilution. So we feel, well, we want the lower dilution. So we stuck with the dye study. But, you know, we feel really the latest information is from 2001, which is not that outdated. The state of art right now is to use models as opposed to actually putting dyes into discharges, because that kind of, you know, gets everybody up in alarms when they see the bay turning red or green or whatever. And it's a lot costlier because you got to send boats out to actually take samples. So.
Yeah. Any other?
I tell you the truth that far field station comment by baykeeper or discharge of a stormwater which was not affected or polluted, which bypassed only by visual checks, I thought it was adequate. I felt that is this kind of common practice. You don't want to monitor right where the discharge is taking place because you will be monitoring the pollutant. But they are asking for priority pollutant monitoring in the stormwater, what they are asking for, the baykeepers. And what is the reason for doing that? I mean, I don't know if there is a pollutant there or something. They are suspecting there will be something like that.
I believe there's just a concern that stormwater is contaminated with more pollutants than what our conventional monitoring requires. So we did require priority pollutant monitoring at the stormwater discharge point that had the highest total suspended solids. And most of these priority pollutants, you know, they're going to bind to solids because they're hydrophobic. So we feel like we addressed their concern by requiring that monitoring when we issued the tentative order. They would just like it at more of the stormwater outfalls, but we don't really view that as good value. We feel like we can focus on this one outfall and see what we get from that data.
You know, I'd like to make some comment. Recently, I went to Valero, a refinery in Martinez, and I was really impressed. First of all, that the security system is of such a high standard that we had to go through, it seems like going through a military outfit, even stricter than going to Lockheed buildings, you know, this is a military outfit over there. But they have such a high standard and so much effort they put in the water quality and the refinement, water quality treatment. I was impressed by the degree of professionalism they show in every aspect. And so I'm very sure that the Shell refinery in Martinez probably is of the same standard, because I was impressed. I have already taken tour of two refineries. I think the baykeeper should take a tour of refineries before they should make some comment. Maybe next time they invite a tour of refineries, the baykeeper representative should be included on the tour and see what standard they have and come prepared, because they may get some idea that these are professional people and they do want to do a great job. When something happens, they do immediately respond, and they have such a response system. All kind of central computer system, and they give immediate alarm if something exceeds, and immediately somebody responds to it. They shut down the plant, and all these kind of system they have that is, so maybe this, you guys should take a tour of that. You might have taken a tour. Maybe I'm speaking in void over here. So get a little impression that they are professional people. I was impressed. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Board Member McGrath?
A couple comments. I'm going to support the staff recommendation. Let me start with the tour of Valero. I mean, it is inherent in industrial wastewater that it is harder to treat. Oil water mixed in a stream of production and refining of oil is much harder to treat. There's a lot more that goes into the treatment plant. It's a dirty process, and it's pretty effectively contained. It's the positive hydraulic control and the routing of that runoff into the system for treatment that adds it. But you know, the stormwater is much less problematic than the wastewater. And when the first flush of the stormwater, in fact, goes into the same treatment system, you're getting a fine level of treatment. I mean, that's the first observation. Second, I want to make it absolutely clear that we agree with the staff, or I agree with the staff, on the use of Yerba Buena as a reference station. It is, if you look at any of the data that's been collected over the last 20 or 30 years about trends,
the Central Bay has become cleaner, and using a cleaner reference standard as a basis for comparison, in fact, as the staff laid out in the response to comments, makes the comparison tougher. So it is a more protective standard. There's no weaknesses. Now, there are limitations in the regional monitoring program. It is not as robust as some would like it, but it's also the best in the country. And it gives us, I think, unlike most other regions with comparable aquatic systems, it gives us a pretty good idea of trends over time. I do want to distance myself from one comment in the staff's response, which I found problematic, which is that the basis for regional monitoring, and this is on page 8 of the use of the RMP station provides the board a defensible base for requiring Shell to continue to support the RMP. We require monitoring of discharges. It can be done in different ways. It is not essential for Shell or required for Shell to participate in the regional monitoring program. But 20 or so years ago when the regional monitoring program surfaced and I lobbied for the dredgers to accept it, there are true benefits to something which is far enough afield from the individual sources so that you can get a synoptic trend analysis, and that ends up being beneficial to dischargers who are looking not simply at what's happening at their discharge, but the so what questions. What does it matter in the direction? So I think that's rather unfortunate language. It tends to be more cost effective, not necessarily for the dredgers. They always kvetched about their price. But it does provide the information that I think we need in the long term. It is not as robust as I would like it. It's as robust as we can make it. But I think there's solid monitoring between that overall program, the use of the Farfield station, which in fact has a more rigorous requirement, and the discharge point. So it's tough stuff to treat. It requires a pretty high-tech plant, and they're meeting their discharge requirements, and I think that's what we're looking for.
Shalom?
Yeah, I will support the staff recommendation, but really I have a question. Is that really dilution or dissipation? Dissipation more than dilution.
I think, well, with the dilution credit that we grant, I believe, is more dilution because that's the initial of the water coming out of the pipe.
How do you spell
and then dissipation, the dissipation occurs as that plume just gets dragged and smeared in the water body.
Clear after some
right.
distance.
Yes. It becomes almost, yes.
You don't find it.
Right.
So
very pretty,
really
relatively quickly, yes. But we think restrictions on dilution credit are appropriate.
That'd be a great question to have these UC fancy Berkeley students and Stanford students study that one there. Vice Chair?
It's dissipation.
I'm comfortable with the use of the Farfield station. I not only in theory, but I also have come to rely on the scientists at SFEI and the RMP, and I think they do a very good job. And as Jim points out, we have a remarkable regional monitoring program. I did want to look at some of the other comments that Baykeeper made. I think that they used the comments on this particular permit to highlight some generic issues which we should take seriously and keep in mind as we go through the series of permits that we go through for this geographical area. First of all, there are comments with respect to the selenium dilution credit. I have to agree that the documentation of this dilution credit for bioaccumulative substance has been a little bit suboptimal. But the bottom line here, as Jim would say, for the ecological system is the amount of mass that's discharged. The fact that this permit maintains the same limit for mass discharge of selenium makes me comfortable enough to go ahead, even though I think in this and previous permits we've been a little messy in our language. The second two issues have to do with the rare and endangered species. The first issue was to look at the geometry or the mapping of multiple mixing zones in this geographic location. As I sit here as a board member, I actually don't have in my brain a map of where the mixing zone is for this refinery and all of the other dischargers that are in the area. So I don't actually know how far an endangered salmonid would travel inside mixing zones versus in the area that where we don't allow mixing and we have a different standard. That would be useful information, and perhaps it is so small to be de minimis in this case. I truly don't know. I'm hearkening back to an exercise that I did back when I used to sit in the audience and have a different role in these kinds of proceedings, and I actually did look at a region that shall remain nameless, not this one, and mapped the multiple mixing zones, and it turned out that in this river, the salmon, in order to get clean water, they'd have to go way to the right up here, and then way to the left, and then swim way to the right, and it was just a checkerboard of mixing zones, which is not what the law intended. So I know we have a great challenge ahead of us accomplishing everything that the staff has to accomplish with a small amount of time, but paying attention to the geometry of the multiple mixing zones is a relevant issue. And it would be nice to just have some information that the public could look at to see what's going on there. The second issue having to do with rare and endangered species is the fact that there is an ongoing, I tend to forget because it's been going on for so long, a discussion between the Fish and Wildlife Service and EPA and therefore us about what the appropriate standards are for endangered species and whether the California Toxics Rule is protective enough. Perhaps in a future executive officer's report, we could kind of have an update as to where that issue stands. I personally have lost track of where all the lawsuits are that are going to tell us how to deal with this. And I appreciate the Baykeeper reminding us that we need to remember that that's going on.
That's it. Well, I think everyone, it's kind of interesting. We've had some uncontested refineries before us here recently, and this one here, we've kind of been vetted a little bit, a little deeper in the area here. So I think we've all had a good discussion at it. My comment would be that, as the representative of Shell, Mr. Lesher, stated earlier, it wasn't everything they wanted, but I think it's a pretty darn good permit out there for workable for all parties included in staff's hard work there. I'm sure there's not a moment in the day that goes by that they're not concerned about an environmental issue. I mean, that's their life. And for them to continue to operate, they're going to have to continue to think this way. And I think our Bay Area refineries, and I didn't tour Valero, but I'm sure it's a good one too. As I always say, 1 month we kind of give you a plaque and a permit, and next month we fine you. So just have to be careful where it's at there. So we don't want to get too deep in the friendship here, but they know they have to do it, and we need them to do it, but we also need them as a resource, because we're not going to go too far out of here if we're not having corporations that are stepping up and trying to do the best thing they can. But they know they're aware of it, and Baykeepers are sitting on top of them, and I'm sure they communicate somewhere along the way with their governmental relations people and representatives of trade associations, because it has to be a project together to make sure that they can keep operating in business. So I'm very comfortable with the location and the monitoring that's going on now, and I'm ready for staff recommendation.
Thank you. As part of my recommendation, I wanted to reinforce Jim's comments about the fact that this is very rigorous. It's a challenge for the refineries because they have so many parts of their process. It's a challenge to be able to treat adequately and address all those processes. As you saw from the slide that Robert had up there, this refinery is very immense. It's almost like a small city. And in fact, the refineries essentially are the only ones who are treating a significant quantity of stormwater day in and day out, because in most cases they have a significant portion of their facility that runs off into their wastewater collection system, and so they're actually treating that. Here, there's a portion, especially on the east side, that is not plumbed to the wastewater treatment facility, but as Robert says, there's adequate protections and treatment for that stormwater runoff. And so I think, by and large, the refineries do very exemplary work on addressing stormwater, at the same time addressing the challenges they have for wastewater treatment. So I think Terry's comments are well taken on how do we address rare endangered species in this area. We've had this issue, obviously, recently with Central San and Vallejo, and we'll be continuing to address that in the broader regional approach. But that points, again, back to the use of the regional monitoring program and a reliance on that for not only Shell, but all of our other dischargers, so we have a broad understanding. Certainly, the regional monitoring program can be tweaked, and we do that on a regular basis. As you commented earlier today, you sat in on some of those meetings where we're looking at constant improvement. But as Jim noted, you know, the best in the country, and we're going to continue to run with it and see how we can improve it as we move forward. With that, I do recommend adoption of the revised tentative order you have before you.
Move for adoption.
I second it.
Move and second. Any further discussion? Not roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr.
Elliott. Aye.
Mr.
Aye.
Dr.
Singh. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So ordered, and thank all parties that have been working on this. And moving on to item number 8.
Item 8 is enforcement action, where we are separating functions, and so I want to see, I understand.
We have no cards at this time.
Okay, that we do have prosecution team, board prosecution team, and board advisory team. So we'd like to sort of split up our seating.
So we have to go through the motions anyway here.
But we still are, because the advisory team does have a supplemental, which I think you have in front of you.
Yeah, we do.
As we set up having the prosecution team on that side, the advisory team over on this side.
Good guys here, bad guys there.
Before the
grandkids.
The prosecution team makes a presentation, I'd like Gary on behalf of the advisory team to make some. Pardon me? Oh, and Tamron, who are part of the advisory team, along with me, and these folks over here are part of the prosecution team. I'd like Yuri to make some comments on behalf of the advisory team.
Sure. I just wanted to make clear that...
Oh, the prosecution team's falling apart here. It's lunchtime.
No cheating.
So, yes, this is an enforcement action, but I wanted to make clear that the board's not being asked to determine the merits of the case or determine any facts. Basically, you're being asked to whether a referral to the Attorney General's office is appropriate. This may come back to the board for as a future enforcement item, so it's important that the board, you know, not make a enforcement decision, because we don't want to prejudge any future enforcement action. So with that, perhaps the prosecution team can identify themselves and begin with their presentation.
For the record, this is Diane White, Assistant Executive Officer, and I've been leading the prosecution team for this effort. On our team, we have Lila Tang in the NPDES and Enforcement Division, and then representing us from the Office of Enforcement is Ann Catherine Benedict. Brian Thompson will be giving the presentation today. He's the senior in the Enforcement Section, and if there are any other questions, I have Nathan King, who is the caseworker here in our Cleanup Division. This presentation is fairly brief, and I've asked Brian to just essentially cover the history of the case and what got us to where we are today. With that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Good morning, Chairman Muller, members of the board. I'm Brian Thompson, a senior engineering geologist and enforcement section leader, and I am making this presentation on behalf of the prosecution staff. It is our position that a referral to the Attorney General is needed to obtain compliance from Hyung Kyung Sun and Yao Nam Sun for matters pertaining to the Art Cleaners site. We make this recommendation because a progression of enforcement steps taken by staff and by the board have not been able to achieve compliance, and because pollutants found at Art Cleaners are considered a threat. Hyung Kyung Sun and Yao Nam Sung, whom I will collectively refer to as the Suns in this presentation, own the property at 400 East Santa Clara Street in San Jose. This property was historically used as an automotive service station and is currently being used to operate a dry cleaner under the business name of Art Cleaners. This is the site I will be referring to during this presentation. An investigation in September 2002 detected pollutants at the site consistent with service station and dry cleaner use. PCE was detected in soil near the dry cleaning machine, shown in red, and petroleum compounds were detected in soil and groundwater in the area of the former automotive service station. Following discovery of pollutants at the site, the Santa Clara Valley Water District issued requirements to the Suns to compel additional investigation. After 3 years of working with the Suns, no additional work was conducted at the site. In 2005, the Santa Clara Valley Water District transferred oversight of the case to the Regional Water Board. Board staff have since tried working with the Suns to compel additional investigation and get the nature and extent of pollutants at the site characterized, but the Suns have continued to dismiss staff's efforts and ignore requirements in board orders. Here are some of the examples of these efforts in the record. In 2007, the Suns did not respond to a letter requesting participation in our site cleanup program. In 2008, the Suns were required to submit a technical investigation work plan, but did not, and a notice of violation was issued. In 2009, the Suns were required to submit a site history report, which we received 252 days late. In 2010, the board imposed a $25,646 administrative civil liability as a penalty for noncompliance, which the Suns have not paid. In 2011, the Suns did not comply with the first task in a cleanup and abatement order, and a notice of violation was issued. Pollution found at the site is a concern. Because of the unknowns associated with it, and because of the problems that can result from petroleum, and in particular, solvent releases to the environment, we still have some questions about the nature of chemicals used and the sources of discharges at the site. The extent of the petroleum and PCE releases have not been defined, and there has been no investigation to determine if pollutants are present in soil gas. We cannot effectively regulate the site from a state of unknowns, and what was found in 2002 could be the proverbial tip of the iceberg. Based on the data we do have, there are some real potential threats to consider. petroleum constituents are present in groundwater at the site, shown in red, and PCE is present in soil at concentrations exceeding the levels needed to leach into groundwater. These pollutants may be migrating away from the site in groundwater, and there are 8 active water supply wells located within a 1-mile radius. Pollutants also may be migrating in soil gas from contaminated soil and from contaminated groundwater if volatile constituents off-gas. It is through soil gas that there may be an exposure pathway to surrounding buildings and a potential for impacts to indoor air. This is a concern because the site is located in the immediate vicinity of a residential community, and there are 2 schools, a nursery, and a university within a 3-block radius. These buildings are outlined in yellow. Concerns about the site have driven board staff to obtain compliance from the Suns, but without success. It is time to seek other tools to accomplish this goal. The tentative resolution before you today, if adopted, will elevate enforcement of the following matters to the Attorney General: payment of the $25,646 liability imposed by the Administrative Civil Liability Order, and compliance with investigation and cleanup requirements in the Cleanup and Abatement Order. The Attorney General can compel compliance with these orders through court litigation. Our staff would provide support to the Attorney General's office to work on resolutions, which could include actions like a judgment and collections from the liability payment, an injunction for further investigation and cleanup, and higher penalties for noncompliance. In posting the tentative resolution for public comments, we received 1 letter from the Isola Law Group on behalf of the Suns. A copy of the letter is in your board package. This letter stated that a claim was made in 2011 to obtain insurance funding to help pay for cleanup, and it included a request to delay this hearing for 60 to 90 days. Prosecution staff opposed delaying the hearing as presented in the May 2012 letter from the State Board's Office of Enforcement to the Isola Law Group. A copy of the letter is in your board package. The Suns have had almost 10 years to make an insurance claim, and postponement of the hearing would only result in further delay. We also received no comments to explain why the outstanding liability has not been paid. In summary, there are 3 good reasons for making this referral to the Attorney General. 1, the Suns have a history of being non-responsive to staff and for ignoring requirements in board orders. The record demonstrates that further actions by the Water Board are not likely to have an effect on gaining compliance. 2, pollution that was found in 2002 has remained uninvestigated for almost 10 years, despite numerous requirements placed upon the Suns by the Santa Clara Valley Water District and our agency, and this pollution is considered a threat to water quality and use, human health, and the environment in the absence of additional information. 3, the Attorney General has different legal tools available to it for achieving compliance beyond what the board can do. That ends my presentation.
If I could just add a few things. To the best of my knowledge, the Suns are indeed aware of the hearing today. In fact, we had arranged to have a Korean translator present at the hearing to facilitate things for them. We learned, I think it was 2 days ago, from the Isola Law Group that they would not be attending the hearing with no explanation in regard to why. We also learned that the Isola Law Group, although they have been representing them, they are not representing them in this matter. They're only representing them in terms of evaluating other RPs in the area and trying to secure insurance funds to pay for the cleanup. And that's essentially all the information that we have at this point.
Okay, Vice Chair.
Yes, we have a supplemental on this item.
Right.
And I just wanted to...
Once you have finished questions for prosecution team, advisory team, we'll discuss the supplemental.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions from the west side?
If I'm correct, I don't know if there's any record of what responses they had through the Santa Clara County Water District, but the only response that there appeared to have had is they finally submitted a history of the property 3/4 of a year late. That's the only response other than please delay.
And they also signed up, and they signed the cost recovery agreement.
And they signed a cost recovery agreement. Now, on the factual basis, we know there's potential pollution, but we don't know that represents both a health risk and a water quality risk. We don't know the degree because they've not characterized it. So on a factual basis, we're only presuming that we have this small amount of information available, and the normal way is to characterize the site adequately, figure out whether or not remediation is necessary and how best to do it and the like. But on the other factual part of non-responsiveness, where there have been a number of written communications to the Soons reminding them of their liabilities and there's non-response, we're entitled to look at that.
Yes, you are.
Okay. So now, I guess the last point on that, where we have served them by mail, and we know their address because they are a property owner of record, and where we have heard from an attorney representing them on at least a portion of that and informing them of and informing us of their intention not to attend, I think we're presumptively allowed to understand that they have true notice of this.
Correct.
Okay. Certainly, if they've not responded to administrative activities and it's a pollution of substantial concern in proximity to public sensitive public health receptors like schools, it's time to increase the level of progressive action. So.
Okay, so any other further questions?
Oh. I just want to be satisfied that the defendants are aware that this hearing is taking place today and they chose intentionally not to appear today here. Is it right?
As far as we know.
Yes, in communicating with them, we've been sending them things hard copy through the mail, sending them the information electronically through email, and making telephone calls, and I have records of those. We also have been engaging with their attorneys through our attorney, and were notified them that they did not. Their understanding was they did not plan to attend from their attorneys.
What I'm trying to ask that when there is a court hearing, there is a process server who serves the paper on them. Now, I don't know if it is required in our case that make sure that they receive the paper. Where was the paper sent? To the Sun dry cleaner in San Jose, or it was sent to the owners where they are? They are out of state. Right?
It was sent to the owners, not the operators at their business, but to the owners.
By simple mail or registered mail or certified mail?
Certified mail.
And they received it?
We received the certified mail back, and upon which time I called them. Actually, I called them before because we had information that we had not got the slip back. Mm-hmm. So I contacted them and talked to them on the phone, at which point they said they were going to come by and pick it up. I got their, confirmed their email address and sent it to them electronically.
Only reason I'm asking these questions because I went in a case against a defendant in the court, and they raised doubt about the service, and the court didn't allow the proceeding if the proper service has been done. So we had to reservice it through process server, and then we had to come back on another court date. Mm-hmm. So they were very particular about it. They can dismiss the case if it's not proper service. But I don't know what is required in our case, what kind of service. I think that a certified letter is probably sufficient for this case, I guess.
If I may, I just wanted to remind you that the Sons are not yet a defendant. That's what you're deciding, whether to make them a defendant by referring this matter, in which case, you know, service will be handled correctly.
We haven't got to the court thing yet.
Yes, yes.
Okay. All we're trying to do today is close the public hearing, correct, in some terms?
You're trying to decide whether you want to elevate this and send this on to the Attorney General's office.
Yeah. It's pretty simple. So, from my perspective, anyway, we've We've had them before here. We've discussed this with them. We've worked really hard with them through translators and tried to do our very, very best. And I think we have no choice but to continue to set an example that we can't let these things go on any further. So I don't know what the next step is other than we're ready to move forward.
Well, with that, let me have Yuri on behalf of the advisory team describe the revisions that the advisory team feels are appropriate for the tentative resolution.
So these are changes which I've shared with the prosecution team. I don't know if they have any comments on it, but I'll just go over the main points of the changes. I deleted the reference to the administrative civil liability, referring that because, as I understand it, the Attorney General's office is not taking collection cases, nor is it necessary to refer an unpaid ACL to the AG's office in order to collect on it. We could do that in-house, so I'm striking that. I also struck the reference to the 13-67 order because that order has been enforced through the ACL order, so you know we don't need to, or we can't actually enforce that again. We only have one bite at the apple. What else? I took out language that the discharger are civilly liable. You know, again, that's a factual determination that's, to be made in court or perhaps, by you in a future date if it comes to us administratively. And then finally, and this is kind of important, I made the referral subject to available resources because there may not be enough money to support, to pay the AG's office to actually, pay them to do this. So that's kind of an important detail. So those are the main changes. I don't know if the prosecution team has any issues with them.
Shalom has a quick question.
Is the previous user has any liability?
I'm sorry, previous user, can you...
The gas station. The gas station.
Can the prosecution team answer that? I don't know enough about the prior history.
Right now we've issued a number of 13-267 orders to other potential responsible parties, and we are getting site history information from them now, and we will be making those determinations down the road. So we're just in the process of figuring out who else is potentially liable.
So if in the process of investigation we find out that really the pollution is from the gas station, they have liability.
Yes, we will modify the orders accordingly. But we do have, I guess I don't know to what degree I can go into this, but as we presented to you when we presented the ACL to you, we have sufficient information that illustrates the link between what we're seeing with the solvents used as part of the dry cleaning operations there. So we're further investigating other components of the site.
There is still a dry cleaner operating at the site, presumably paying rent to the Suns, is there not?
Correct.
So... They are achieving an economic benefit from the property with the potential for pollution, and they're ignoring the regulatory response to that. So it is not one where they have abandoned the site, and perhaps what we have to do is figure out what happens when somebody abandons an underwater property. They're deriving economic benefits from the site. We don't know whether or not the economic value of the site after we figure out what needs to be done to properly remediate it will be sufficient or not. I mean, those are all things that you undertake with an investigation, which they've refused to do. But I think the point that I want to make on the record is they are deriving an economic benefit knowing the potential for further contamination. And that, to me... makes it quite a bit different than an old abandoned site, which is gradually perhaps dissipating its contaminants. There's a risk of fresh contamination each and every day. And so to me, that's why we will try to encourage ways to find money for the Attorney General's office to remediate this problem, or to get it on that path.
Okay. And you traveled all the way down here to visit with us, so do you have any comments on this issue?
Thank you very much. I don't have any comments that haven't been covered by the presentation, just to say that other than, you know, it's time that these people be held accountable for this property, and I think the documentation and past history really sets forth why. So thank you very much for having me today.
Okay. So I think we're ready to go back.
So it then falls on the advisory team to make a recommendation, and I would recommend that the board adopt the revised tentative resolution as described by Yuri.
I would
and
so move.
In the supplemental before you.
Second.
Is it supplemental?
Moved and second. Any further discussion? I think the main thing that Vice Chair, you know, just mentioned to me, we want to ensure on the record that they understand how serious this is. From all of our board perspective. So I want to make that clear for the record. Thank you, Tasha. We'll get you lunch soon. Off the record.
You're going to give her for lunch.
We'll have a roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliopoulos.
Aye.
Mr.
McGrath.
Aye.
Dr.
Seuss. Aye.
Aye.
Dr. Young.
Aye.
Aye, so ordered, and thank you for coming down.
We did a million before.
And then, Sam, you've been very patient here today, so we'll give you your due respect here.
Right.
As long as we get some restoration funds for our creeks.
Yeah, as it were. So our last item is an information item on the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, and Sam Shukat, who's executive officer of the State Coastal Conservancy, has been good enough to come today and enjoy our meeting, seeing how other agencies work, to be part of this and explain what the Restoration Authority is and where it's headed. With that, I'd say thanks, Sam, and welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. Good afternoon, Chairman Mahler, members and staff. I am Sam Shukat, Executive Officer of the State Coastal Conservancy. I'm also the Chairman of the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, and I'm speaking to you today in that capacity. The staff report gave a nice, concise background on what the Restoration Authority is, so I will assume that you know that, and of course, feel free to ask me any questions. The authority had been on a path towards going to the voters in the Bay Area with a measure, most likely a parcel tax, to fund wetland restoration, flood control, and access to the Bay. We were thinking of doing that in 2012. Unfortunately, the poll that we did in July of 2011 showed that we did not have the two-thirds vote that we would need to be successful. The authority has done two polls, one in 2010, one in 2011. We did a focus group in between. Save the Bay, which is working very closely with us, had done a poll in 2007. And basically what it showed was willingness to pay for restoration of the Bay was declining as the economy declined. And 2011, in retrospect, was pretty near the bottom of the recession. It's interesting to point out that even as bad as the economy was, we have almost two-thirds support for what we were proposing. We didn't even really get to two-thirds in the Oakland, Berkeley, Emeryville, San Francisco, what I like to call the axis of liberalism within the Bay Area. So even in that region, we couldn't quite get to two-thirds. We did hypothesize, and you see that there's two. There's an overall, there's an area B. We thought to ourselves, well, maybe people that live closer to the Bay, that's Area B, would be more supportive. As you can see, it's really just within the margin of error of the poll. That's Area B. Those are actually school districts. So it's the people that essentially live more or less within sight of the bay, as opposed to eastern Alameda and eastern Contra Costa County and northern Marin and Sonoma. But there wasn't much difference in opinion there. So the board decided to hold off. We're tentatively thinking about going to the voters in 2014. And in the meantime, we've been quite busy with those things. We have a bill in the legislature, AB 1656, that makes some technical corrections to our enabling legislation and also extends the sunset date because, of course, it's now, I think, 6 years since the original legislation was passed, and we haven't actually gone to the voters yet. We are working on some very spiffy outreach materials to use in our outreach work. There's a brochure in development that I'm sure you'll see when it's available. The outreach materials are based on our polling and in our focus groups, and I do want to... You'll be interested to know a little bit about what the public thinks about... wetland restoration in the Bay Area. Interestingly, I think for what you do, reducing trash and toxics in the Bay is the most compelling message in favor of the measure. That's consistent across all of the polling that we in Save the Bay has done. It's also generally consistent with polling that other people do on environmental issues. Clean water is a really important issue for folks. Interestingly enough, in the focus groups, which I watched, you know, behind the one-way mirror, these were people living in Sunnyvale and Redwood City. They think the Bay is much more polluted than it really is. They think it's so polluted that it would be immediately dangerous to your health to swim in it. So they think that you guys have even more work to do than you actually do. Some of the other messages that we tested, in particular the economic benefits, are much less compelling. You've probably heard about and thought about climate change and sea level rise to some extent. Flooding is not something that voters in the Bay Area are very worried about. I suspect that in places like the city of Napa or along the Russian River, people worry about flooding, but that's because they experience flooding. Even in Santa Clara County, parts of which are 9 feet below sea level, flooding is not something that people think a great deal about. So the outreach material that we are preparing will be based on the opinion research that we've done. I wanted to tell you about an event that you may have read about in the South Bay on April 11th. I had the pleasure to attend the celebration luncheon for the groundbreaking for the BART extension to San Jose. And at that event, Senator Feinstein, who had been instrumental in getting the funding for BART, announced the formation of a steering committee of South Bay notables to look at the question of how to fund the restoration of the bay and flood control. And this map was revealed. And it was a lot of fun to be there because we were in a tent on the grounds of Marvell Corporation. Marvell is a memory manufacturer, and they are let's see, there's the mouse. They're right there, several feet below sea level, right on the bay shore. And basically, many of the senior staff and CEOs of all of these companies were at this event, and they saw that they're either in the 50-year sea level rise band, that's the light pink, 16 inches, the darker red is 55 inches. It really got their attention. They became quite interested in the question of restoring the bay and in providing flood control. Senator Feinstein was able to strong-arm the Silicon Valley Leadership Group to become a part of this steering committee, which includes the mayor of San Jose, the Bay Area Council, myself, David Lewis from Heal the Bay, and it's chaired by the Steve McCormick at the Moore Foundation. So we now have a sort of a ready-made, high-level business outreach group, at least in the South Bay. So thinking that we are heading for 2014, the staff, which is really my staff at the Coastal Conservancy and ABAG, along with Save the Bay, have been busy meeting with stakeholders around the bay to talk about what we're planning, and from my perspective, this is a stakeholder meeting. We're asking our board and advisory committee members to identify 5 to 10 outreach targets and go meet with them. We have a over 20-person advisory board mandated by the legislation that created us. It includes all of the usual suspects as well as some unusual ones. The board itself is seven people, six of whom are elected officials from around the bay. And in the meantime, Save the Bay is putting together a fundraising plan and a campaign plan, assuming that we would go in 2014. We think that it will cost about $5 million to get on the ballot and win an election, which is a somewhat daunting figure. Eventually, there'll have to be a separate campaign committee because neither Save the Bay nor the Restoration Authority, nor, you know, me as a state official, obviously, can work on elections. We don't actually have to pull the trigger on whether we want to go to the voters in 2014 until about June of that year. So we have some time. Our next board meeting, which are generally shorter than your board meetings, will be July 25th from noon until 2 o'clock. You can bring your lunch. We all do. You're welcome to attend. And if any of you would like to help us with the process of reaching out to Bay Area constituent groups and stakeholders and voters, we'd love to have the help. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Thanks for your work.
And you'll be happy to know, by the way, that the work to replace the 90-year-old sewer lateral at my house is beginning this week, since it has started to leak.
There was a symptom?
Yeah, there was a symptom.
So approved. So we thank you for... it is a daunting task, what you're out there asking to do. And but it's probably a good call, because a number of us have parcel tax measures on the ballot this year. And the governor does, too. And I you know, it's a tough one. But our city just passed an $80 million school bond one, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, roughly half of the 48% of the measures regionally that needed two-thirds vote passed in the election last week, closer to two-thirds of the ones that needed 55%, like a school bond, passed. So, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. That to me seems not so bad, given, you know, how bad the economy still is.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments or thank yous? Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Hold it. Thank you. All right, so
with that,
members, we're going to, Steve's buying lunch for all of us upstairs. And, oh, we got a 5% cut.